Okay. All right. I'm not seeing the recording. There it goes.
Okay. There it is.
All right. Welcome to the Jefferson County Public Hospital District Number 2 Board of Commissioners meeting on Wednesday, November 17th, 2021. This is a special meeting because due to the upcoming Thanksgiving holiday, we have changed the date from the regular fourth Wednesday of the month to the third. This meeting will consist of three parts: Board Governance Education from 2 till 2:15, Board Education from 2:15 to 3:15, when we will take a 15-minute recess and reconvene at 3:30 for our business session, which will include an executive session to discuss real estate and performance of an employee. This session is being officially audio recorded, and times shown on the agenda are estimates. This virtual meeting is being held under Governor Inslee's COVID-19 Notice of Proclamation 2028, and the only live public comment period will be during the, that was from last month. The number to access this meeting by telephone is 509-598-2842. Our community members are welcome to comment on any item or concern via a letter addressed to the commissioners at 834 Sheridan Street, Port Townsend, 98368, or via email to commissioners@jeffersonhealthcare.org. All commissioners are present. Our thanks for ramrodding the technical portion of today's meeting to Brittany Huntingford, who is filling in for Alyssa Rodriguez. As this is our special meeting, there is no approval of the agenda, so we're going directly to our education session. So we have nothing really scheduled for our first 15 minutes, so we may discuss anything the board would like. We just have to keep it within the time frame. Any takers? As an alternative, we can give up our time to the next speakers and have them go more into their topic.
Sounds reasonable.
Okay, is that, do I have consensus on that?
I think that sounds great.
Okay.
Yes.
All right, Matt?
Good. Sounds good.
Okay. So if you are ready, then is Dunia, I see Dunia is here. Today's education topics are a progress report on Jefferson Healthcare's health equity mission, followed by the home health and hospice report. So Dunia Fox, our care transformation and population health director, and Tina Herschelman, marketing and community engagement coordinator, will update us on our very important health equity progress. Thank you, Dunia and Tina. Who wants to begin?
I will jump right in. Thank you so much for having us again. I get the opportunity to speak to our commissioners quite regularly, and I really appreciate these conversations. And so I was thinking, it felt like I had just given an update, but really it's been quite a while. And so this almost feels a little bit like a year in review. I was thinking back to where I was a year ago, and it was my last day of last week of maternity leave. And I had actually come back and really kicked off some of the equity work. Starting next week would be the 1 year anniversary. So it feels very apropos to be doing this right now with you. Next slide, please. So today we're going to talk a little bit about sort of the work that we've done with partnering with other organizations and participating in some different initiatives. We're going to talk about our equity strategic plan for 2021 and see where we are with that. I'm really going to do a big deep dive into data and analytics because a lot of the last year has focused on what we've been doing around the data. Talk a little bit about a new initiative that we've been working around real data collection, and then also talk about next steps. And I'm hoping that this is a conversation. And if we end a little early, I will cede my time to Tammy Tarsa, who's coming up next. Next slide, please, Brittany. We have been starting most of our meetings now with our land acknowledgement, which we all reviewed whenever we were out in Port Ludlow. And so I just want to put this up on the screen for a moment. It's also on our website too. Next slide. And I like to entitle this part of the presentation about taking advantage of all of the opportunities that we've been afforded around equity. And so looking really closely at all the things that we've been doing. We've been part of two different collaborative or cohorts, depending on the word that you want to use, one from the IHI and also one from WISHA. So I'm going to do a little bit of a deep dive, and I'm inviting Tina to jump in whenever she feels appropriate. Next slide. So I think that you have been most abreast of the work that we've been doing with the IHI, the Institute for Healthcare Improvement. This is just an overview of their wheel and the way that they think about using, about implementing equity within an organization. They look at building infrastructure, addressing the multiple determinants of health, not only the ones that we see within the clinic, which is obviously a tenet of population health here at Jefferson Healthcare. It's eliminating racism and other forms of oppression, partnering with the community to improve health equity, and then making health equity a strategic priority, which I would say we've done exceptionally well at, and I'm excited to just reiterate some of the progress that I think you've heard from Mike and others in previous board meetings about what our 2022 strategic plan looks like. The IHI framework has been helpful in helping us develop our own strategic framework and priorities here. We pretty much follow their focus, although we, of course, Jeffersonized it a little bit, and I'll review that in a couple of slides. Some of the interesting things about the IHI is that there's a lot of opportunity for engagement, and they also run their Zoom meetings incredibly well. We have a data and analytics side where the data folks like myself and Adam York, who's the data representative on the team, sit in and really dig into what we're doing with the data, how we're looking at numbers, how we're collecting the numbers. There's an entire group that's focused on addressing racism and having some of those hard conversations around addressing racism as an institution and as an individual that works within an institution. And really, I think that they've done a phenomenal job of painting the picture and moving forward with a lot of the work that they have been doing. CASE has been intimately involved in this as well. This has been a lot of the work that we've been looking at. Next slide. But the newest work that we have endeavored is we couldn't just join one collective. We had to join all of them that we had opportunity to. And so we also joined the Washington State Hospital Association Equity Collaborative. And it was a different feel from the very beginning, and it was very WISHA, which was awesome. It's been very helpful. And so while the IHI has really focused on big picture ideas and conversations and digging into what is equity, WISHA has spent a lot of time really looking at how do we actually make change within our organizations here in Washington and Oregon. And so it's over both of those two states. We are looking at it from what they call to be sprints. And so over the course of our about year and a half in the Equity Collaborative with WISHA, there will be three sprints. And that's what you're seeing on the screen is a tiny calendar of the sprints. Really, 1 month is spent doing some learning and planning of what we want to focus on, and then you spend 3 months digging into what you want to actually change. I'll talk about what we chose here in a minute. There is 1 month of rest in between these, although I don't think December is going to be very restful for us. And then you start it over again and you do another sprint. We haven't decided what the future sprints are going to be looking like, but I do think we'll probably continue a lot of our work in data and analytics. And the first sprint ended up being, well, where do we really need to see change around our data? And it ended up being on the collection side of things. I'm going to do a deep dive more into the real data collection process. But I think the sprint really pushed what we were doing around real collection, and that's the race, ethnicity, age, and language, with all of our patients who come to us. And so that essentially gave us the structure and forced us to dig deep and say, all right, how are we going to make sure that we're asking every person who comes through our doors these questions so that we're giving them the most appropriate care possible? And so that is what drove sort of that initiative. I'm hoping for the future sprints we'll look at something similar, but that, again, has yet to be decided. Whenever I was asked for feedback around the sprints, I was torn a little bit. We had spent so much time working with the IHI where a lot of it was conversations and digging into the definitions and what does this mean for us, and then was being put in a position where I could actually implement a lot of things that we had been talking about, but we didn't do as much talking as I thought we might in the WISHA Equity Collaborative. And of course they said, well, how would you like to make it better? And Tina and I voluntold a little bit to do a roundtable discussion, which was phenomenal. We actually took pieces that we had learned from the IHI. They do these things called capsule projects, where you essentially bring everyone in who's on the call and you say, you all work at Jefferson Healthcare now. You're all part of our team and we have a problem and how do we solve it together? Which was amazing. I actually wasn't able to be at the actual roundtable because I was out sick, but Tina led it phenomenally. And I don't know, Tina, if you want to hop in and just say a little bit about some of the learnings you had or the experience you had leading that conversation with other WISHA hospitals that were part of this.
Well, I will just say Dunia did a lot of the prep work for us. And so that, and then she gave us the opportunity. And I say us because Adam York was also part of that too. And it was just a really robust conversation with a really engaged crowd of Wishaw hospitals. And it went really deep into all the different nuances of what it means to be patient-centered when you ask some of these questions. So it was just a really engaged, thoughtful group of hospital folks. So
a lot of learnings came from that. And I think it started potentially, I'm not going to, jump the gun here, but I think it started a little bit of something that they want to implement in the future, Wishaw does. And so they want another round table. And I'm hopeful that the capsule exercise was as good for everyone else as I think it was for us. Next slide, please. And so how did we actually do, and how did we take all of the learnings that we've been part of to put it into our own equity strategic plan? These are only two of the big collectives that we had been participating in. Some of us have participated in more local work, more work around anti-racism and learning and everything like that. But those are the two big ones that we as an institution participated in. Next slide, please, Brittany. And so this is something that I actually show at all of our health equity meetings. So on the left-hand side here, you'll see Health Equity 2021. So this was always meant to be a one-year plan, and it was bold for 1 year, but we ended up meeting almost everything that we decided to do. And the next, if we're going from left to right, the next column is looking at those big bucket items, and that actually really closely follows the IHI framework. And so making health equity a strategic priority, building the infrastructure, addressing those multiple determinants of health. The one thing that we did add, because we were very interested in remaining local and remaining our focus to be local, is at the bottom we have implementing projects that are going to make a local difference here. From there, we have the actual initiatives that we undertook for this year. I won't go through every single one of them with you. I believe I've handed this out before, but if not, my apologies. We've hit almost all of them. Some of the ones that we haven't made as much progress on, I think, are going to definitely be on the list for 2022. And they were also really, really big efforts that we were trying to do. And so, for example, at the very bottom, utilizing our voice as an anchor institution, that's not a one-year project. That's more like a five-year. And so we took steps toward doing that. And I feel really good about the progress that we had made. We also tried to focus the work both internal and external. And so keeping that balance that we do have a lot to do internally around equity. And we spent a lot of focus on that around our employees, around engagement with our employees, around data that we're looking at, but then also looking at our role in the community and as a leader in the community. And so using our voice in that way. Next slide, please. The huge focus in 2021 was data and analytics. And obviously, this is very near and dear to my heart. So this felt right within my wheelhouse. But it really was informative. And I'm incredibly proud of our data team. And I take very little credit for any of this work. I really say that Adam York, Sean Downing, and the rest of the data and analytics reporting team really drove a lot of this. But huge thanks to Adam and Sean. And you'll see their work mostly coming up here in the next few slides. Next slide, please. So I presented this, I think, in March, whenever I presented as part of the population health update with Dr. Parker. And whenever we first undertook our initial clinical equity project, it was absolutely not planned, but we saw an opportunity, we wanted to address it. And so I'm not going to talk about the data here as much as I'm going to talk about the format. So this is very basic. We were just looking at white vaccination rates versus vaccination rates in the BIPOC and Latinx populations over time. Next slide, please. And this was original. And so this was mostly yours truly putting things into Excel and manipulating it. And that was all. Whenever I included more of the data team, they said, well, how can we make this better? Which is always their first question. And how can we like really make it cool for everyone to look at? Next slide. And that's actually what led us to working around our equity index, which is another IHI thing that we have adopted here. And I've talked a little bit about it before, but really, an appropriate index would be from like 0.9 to 1.1. That's saying that what we would expect to be seeing in terms of positives, in terms of vaccination rates, in terms of quality metrics, is about average. There's not one population that is being overrepresented or underrepresented in those data. So what Adam York specifically did is he took all of our COVID data and he mapped it onto an equity index. So this is comparing percentage distributions across populations. In the red box on the left-hand side, these are our COVID positives. We looked at two different populations and he actually sliced and diced it 100 different ways as well, looking at payer, looking at age, looking at everything. But I just wanted to focus in on the BIPOC or Latinx populations versus white, and then saying, is one population overrepresented compared to the other? And it was true. Again, this is just a short snapshot of earlier in the year, but we did have more COVID positives appearing in our BIPOC and Latinx populations. Remember, we haven't had very many in our community, but just because the N's are small, as Tina always reminds me, it doesn't mean that there is not oppression there. And so we need to be mindful of that and keep repeating it to ourselves. Then we looked at vaccination rates as well, which is something that we as a hospital system really took on and owned over the course of the last year. And in the beginning, our equity index for BIPOC or Latinx population was lower than maybe it should have been in terms of that index. And so we were not vaccinating as many BIPOC or Latinx populations as we could have been doing. As you can see, white or Caucasian was above what we would have expected. However, the trend over time is that our continued outreach to those populations, continued outreach to our partners in that in those communities, working with Dr. Harris, he made that awesome TikTok video that I shared with you back in March, really, I think, paid off because that number did get better and we did see more and more people coming in from that population. So that felt good. But again, I think moving from that really basic graph into something that is more meaningful and that we could apply uniformly across all of our metrics made a huge difference in how we look at equity as an institution. So really using this equity index as the way that we're going to start moving work forward and identifying priorities. Next slide, please. And so we also have a population health dashboard that Adam has worked on significantly. And this is a 2020 snapshot. It's just a screenshot from Tableau. If you hover over any one of these numbers, it'll give you much more information than you ever would have expected. But as you can see at the very top, there's many pages to this. And so this is the front page. It's the highest level. But we also have a demographics page where you do a deep dive into who we're seeing, utilization, early life, SDOH. And right there in the middle is equity. And so those COVID data live now on that equity deep dive. And so it is embedded within our Tableau process that a lot of our leaders and our staff and our providers here use regularly. And so they can really look at what this is telling us over the system.
Adonia, can I ask you something, please?
Yes.
How does age affect these numbers and these results? Is that part of the assessment?
Could you say it a little differently, Mari? What do you mean?
Well, I'm assuming, and maybe I'm incorrect, that the Caucasian population is more elderly, or at least a greater proportion, a greater percentage of our population is Caucasian. The older population over 65, for instance, would be Caucasian. And I don't know if that influences these, I mean, in any way. I have no idea. I'm just asking the question. And is it taken into account? So
we do not do any age adjustment in our analyses right now.
I don't know about age adjustment, but I'm wondering if some of the maybe us older people tend more to, you know, like, for instance, become vaccinated, seek out vaccinations are more, whereas a younger population maybe would not because of whatever reason. And how does that influence it? Maybe I'm overthinking it.
I don't think.
Wondered if age has any relevance to this.
I think it probably does. Where it's the most obvious is whenever you look at the age equity index for COVID vaccinations, where almost everyone that we originally vaccinated was over the age of 65 because that was the mandate. And so they're way overrepresented. And then we have no young people. But we saw that those numbers equal out over time.
Oh, good. Okay.
Yeah, definitely. Good. But in terms of the influence in the BIPOC and Latinx populations. I'm not really sure. We haven't done that deep of a dive to understand more about that specific population and see if that is driving some of this. We do see it in some of our quality metrics as well. Whenever we have a larger population of Medicare folks, most of which are older, and we're saying, wow, there's a lot of Medicare folks that are appearing for their fall risk screening or whatever. Well, that's because they're older and they're more eligible for this quality metric and so on and so forth. And so it absolutely, I think, plays a role, and it's all intertwined within the work that we do, but we haven't specifically pulled up that kind of analysis yet.
Okay, thanks. It just occurred to me that was that swaying things, you know, one way or another.
Yeah, Dunya, would you go back one slide, please? Because I think Mari's on something that is pretty relevant. So if you look at the vaccination rates, the rate is it has a denominator, is that correct?
Correct.
And so if the rate for Hispanic and Latinx is 0.75, and if they have significantly more children than, and therefore young unvaccinated people in the family, then the white population, which as Mari suggested is perhaps overrepresented in the elderly group, that could explain that difference in vaccination rates.
It could, but without doing a deeper dive, I'm not comfortable making any assumptions about what the demographics of our BIPOC and Latinx population look like.
Yeah, no, I'm not suggesting that we should make any conclusions, but I think Mari's question is that possibly a significant variable that would affect the interpretation of the data. And I would think it would, but I don't have the answer either.
It could be. I think this is just a tool to help us identify areas of disparity that we want to start working on specifically. While that might be true on the right-hand side, I can't imagine a world where it also explains the overrepresentation of COVID-19 positives in BIPOC and Latinx populations. Absolutely ask the team to do a little bit deeper.
Right. No, and I would agree. I mean, that's very troubling. And that's data that I think has been borne out in many studies across the country and in the world, actually.
I actually think both an overrepresentation of COVID-19 positives in communities of color and also lower vaccination rates have borne to be true across across the nation. And we didn't really see much different here until we really put the effort into reaching out to our partners in JSERA, reaching out to our partners in the county, and really making those inroads there.
Yep.
Thanks, Dunya.
One more slide, please, Brittany. And so the other place that equity has really been implemented from a data and analytics perspective is right now, Sean manages an incredible list of quality metrics that we track both for our primary care providers as well as our specialty providers. I think that at the last count, there was something like 25 or 28 that he's doing on a quarterly basis, which is a huge amount of work. He does a phenomenal job for that. Well, we tasked him and asked him to look at embedding sort of an equity analysis into each one of those individual quality measures to better understand, okay, how are we doing overall for screening for future fall risk or cervical cancer screening or mammos or colonoscopies or whatever we're trying to measure? We do have to have a certain number of patients in the denominator. And so for things that have very tiny n's in the bottom, we aren't adding in this layer of complexity. But for things like screening for future fall risk, it absolutely is something that we are looking at. So as you can see, we broke it out two different ways. The first way was by race and ethnicity. These data are just through Q3 of 2021. And right now there is no significant difference between the two groups' performance. And so they're doing similarly across the board. We also looked at it by financial class, and that was because during a very high level overview, we had seen some interesting results that came out that said, wow, we think that there's actually a difference between financial class as it's defined here in EPIC. And so that's an EPIC word that I'm using there. And actually with screening for future fall risk, there is a statistically significant difference between commercial and Medicare. And so as you can see at the bottom is where it tells you what the actual difference is. We didn't include Medicaid in this because there was only 24 patients there in the denominator, and that's because screening for future fall risk is one that happens over the age of 65, and so most folks are on Medicare by that point. But commercial did have enough patients in the denominator to say, yeah, there is a significant difference between commercial and Medicare, and how do we improve those numbers? I think whenever we look at any of this, and this is in almost every primary care quality tab that we have there at the top, it goes clinic pod, leaderboard, and then equity. In almost every one of them, there is a place that we could identify ways to improve and to get rid of those disparities. And I think one of the most exciting things that's going to happen next year is talking to Dr. Butterfield and Jen Wharton and Dr. Venable and other leaders in primary care is really looking at this page to help us drive which populations we're trying to get in to get their preventative care taken care of, get their screenings, get their cancer work done, all of it. And so that feels good and it feels meaningful to this group.
So Dunia, one thing that I wonder is, are we actually reaching out to the people and finding out why this is happening so that as a means to a solution?
So depending on the quality measure, absolutely. And there's a million reasons that some of these things don't actually end up happening. Some of it is transportation. Some of it is being able to take time off work to come into an office visit. Some of it is just not thinking it's that important. And so we do have both the care teams as well as some folks from care coordination who do active outreach to populations to say, to individuals to say, how do I get you in to get this taken care of? How do I make sure that you are brought up to speed? The primary care providers have done a phenomenal job in the last few years, really working to manage their panel of patients. And so every quarter they get a list of patients who are due for any one of these different screenings, and they reach out, they have their MAs call, they send my chart messages and letters, as does some folks from my team too. One of the things that we also, I mean, we're very committed to think creatively about how to get individuals in that, you know, it might be more difficult. So if that means doing a lot of Tetrising around appointments, that we're not going to have you come in Monday for your oncology appointment and Tuesday for your primary care and Wednesday for your whatever that is, but to actually move them around so it's easier as a whole, that's something that the entire system is committed to doing. Yeah.
Thank you. That's really, really great. Thank you very much.
Next slide, please. So even though we've done all of this work with data and analytics, we just can't stop. And so our big sprint for WSHA was doing that improving data collection from all of our patients with the race, ethnicity, age, and language in mind. And the reason that we chose this is there was a fair number of individuals who in EPIC had patient declined or unknown as either their race or ethnicity. And best practice is somewhere less than 5% of your patient population. And I should have anticipated you're going to ask me where we are right now, and I do not know. So I'll get in front of that question in a moment. So you can ask, but I still don't know. But we really wanted to, I know it's higher than that, and we really wanted to get it lower and also do some improvement over self. Next slide, please. And so this work is being spearheaded by Jackie Levin and a few others from the Equity Committee, although I will say that I think the most exciting part of our Real Data Collection initiative was that two people from the actual teams, Tisha Davidson and Alex Gee, were like, this is ours, we will own it, and we're going to take it and run with it, which felt awesome. To me, that is a win in itself whenever the organization says, yes, this is mine, I'm doing it. So we did a baseline, both assessing current data and what our data looked like, as well as understanding frontline staff processes and talking to them about how comfortable do you feel gathering this data? What would make you feel more comfortable? What are some of the barriers? Is it time? Is it the EPIC system, what does that look like? They also work to pilot a training around a specific clinic, and I believe that that was in oncology, right, Tina?
I'm not sure. I was going to guess differently. I thought it reached out to Watership, but I'm not sure.
So they chose one place to do it and to say, okay, what does this training look like and what makes the most sense? And then what they're working on right now is understanding if that training was successful. And if it was, then they're going to expand it to other sites across Jefferson Healthcare. And this sounds like a relatively simple training, but given the complexities, both in EPIC and day-to-day, how short-staffed we are, this is actually a pretty big undertaking for the clinic that participated as well as the team that initiated it. One of the big barriers that we had found is that currently in our instance of EPIC, we don't have very many options for ethnicity, which is surprising. There isn't a lot of wiggle room there, but we are tracking with Providence to see if they're going to turn on some more options for us. Just so you know, the reason that I put age in parentheses is because age is gathered anyway because of birthday. And so that's not something that we haven't done very well at. We gather birthdays regularly as well as to help us with insurance purposes. And so it was really around the race, ethnicity, and language were things that we were not gathering. So hopefully over the course of the next few months, we're going to start looking at those numbers and seeing them improve.
Could I ask a question?
Sure.
Where does asking financial information, particularly as it relates to the potential need for discounts or sliding scale or charity care, where does that fit into the whole process?
I don't actually know that. I'm not sure if anyone else on the phone who is more intimately involved with that would know where that goes in the process.
I sent Tyler and Mike Glenn an email recently asking whether we had any data on how often do we or do we not ask that question. But I haven't heard yet, and maybe we will sometime in the future.
So that is our policy.
Oh, not a problem.
It is our policy to ask that question. It's something that we strive to do. There are probably instances where it is missed, but we do ask the question, especially for folks that we know have self-pay, and then that's noted in their EPIC chart as well.
So the short answer, Case, is at every registration, in addition to the state-required notices of that charity care being available. So it is something that's part of our routine.
Right. I guess I'm just curious if we ever look at whether that routine, how often does that routine actually get followed in the same way that we're, and the reason I bring it up is it seems like we're doing a pilot and some training and getting data to see how often certain questions are asked. And I'm wondering whether that should or could or needs to be piggybacked onto this kind of pilot training and or data collection.
And that was on our list for the collection of the real data as well, was just to also bring in full registration training to the team and some scripting tools and techniques. So we're actually going through right now, and Alex and Tisha are going through the training modules available in EPIC, making sure that we're fully trained up before we can roll that out to the registration teams. But that was something that we noticed as well, as if we were going to go out and do one training, we should make sure we have any other trainings that may possibly be needed by the registration team to go out at the same time, so that we're not having to go out multiple times.
So we may have data on that question as well as the race, ethnicity, and language question?
Well, that's probably a question for Dunya and the team tabulating this the real information, if whether sure. This is an the most appropriate place to gather it. I mean, we do a lot of training. Surprisingly, there's a lot of questions that are required to be asked, and each one of those questions is of paramount importance to someone. But I think your point is a good one. How often do we comply with this, and doubling down on training and figuring out some way to check on that sounds like a reasonable quality management thing to do. I'll let Dunya and her team determine if it needs to be added to this work or another body of quality assurance work.
Great, thanks.
Thanks for jumping in, Tyler and Mike. Next slide, please. I thought I was going to be really quick. Sorry, almost done, promise. So just to close this out, I just wanted to talk a little bit, just point out a few things in the organizational strategic plan. And again, Mike or anyone else on SLG who's on this call, please feel free to jump in. But I think one of the other huge wins that we've had this year for health equity is incorporating it into our 2022 strategic plan. And it's pretty much, I think, going to be feathered into all of the tactics that we're doing and the way that we think about work here. But there's two specific places where it is called out. Next slide, please. And those two places are in safety and quality. And it literally says assess and address health equity. And the other place is around our HR practices. And I don't know if Caitlin is on the phone yet, but really looking at data collection around our employees and making sure that we understand our employee population, as well as working on building some competencies within our employee base, including understanding implicit bias, diversity, so on and so forth. And having those called out feels really good. I did an interview with an individual who was looking to work here, and she was looking at our strategic plan, and she said, equity isn't called out anywhere specifically. And I said, you're right, but it will be next year. And so that feels awesome and feels like we're going to use this as a driving force in what we're going to be doing. And next slide. And I'm sorry, Tina, if you had anything else to add. Yeah. And sorry, Tammy, I thought I was going to give you a bunch of extra time, but.
I don't have anything extra to add. You covered everything amazingly, unless anybody has any specific questions.
Questions from the board? Comments?
Well, I would like to make a comment if I could.
Yes, please do. You're on that committee, that task force. I know you must have some insight.
Let's say that I'm learning a lot. How's that? I'm not sure I've gained many insights, but no, I just want to say how truly impressed I am with the work of the team. And I actually, just before Dunya started, I sent to Dunya, Mike, Tina, and the commissioners an email that basically says that I heard a fascinating interview with Rupa, Maria, and Raj Patel, co-authors of a book called Inflamed, Deep Medicine and the Anatomy of Injustice. And the podcast I heard was on a program called For the Wild, dated November 10. And I think it relates directly to our health equity goals. And it was just really a very thought-provoking, just really phenomenal discussion. And in the email I sent, I have a very brief write-up about what's in the book. But I would highly recommend that people just listen to that podcast because it just really gives some broader context of the struggle that we have as a healthcare institution in a system that is so riddled with the problems of systemic racism, and it's just, it helps put the work we're doing in the broader perspective of what really needs to happen in the broader society. And it links very specifically some ideas to the practice of medicine. So I think both administrators, anybody in the healthcare system, including providers who see patients. I think this would be an interesting thing to listen to. I haven't ordered or read the book yet, since I just heard it this morning. So I'm happy to pass that on.
Okay, thank you, Case. All right, then, Dunia and Tina, thank you for a great report and for all of your hard work. It's important work, and we applaud you for all that you're doing for it. And thank you, Case, for representing us well on the board.
Thank you. And we have an amazing team as well, which I don't have a team slide on here, but we have most of SLG, Dr. Parker, Dr. Mattern, Chris Harris, Adam.
Jackie, Adam.
Jackie, yeah. We have a great team that's doing this work, and then it's also being implemented across our organization. So I just get to talk about it, but really it's a huge team effort. So, and thank you, Case, for being on it too. It's been fun. A lot of learning for sure.
Thank you. And we look forward to more reports later on. Okay. All right, then we will move on next to Tammy Tarsa. She's our Executive Director of Home Health and Hospice, and she will give the annual report on hospice and an update on home health.
Yes. Tammy? Hi, thank you. And I'm actually going to divide this presentation in two pieces. The first is going to be a little bit of education on home health. As you remember, about this time last year, I took you through some hospice education in preparation for hospice and palliative care accreditation. And we are now in the throes of home health accreditation. And so as a requirement, I have to provide education to our governing body, which is you, the commissioner. So I'm going to split this, as I said, into two parts. The first is going to be that home health education, and then the second is an annual update on where we are programmatically. So please feel free to jump in if you have questions. I'm going to breeze through some of the slides and spend a little bit more time on others. It's one of the benefits of giving the presentation, but if I go through something too quickly and you want more information, please just stop me and I'll do my best to give it to you. Next slide, please. So the home health accreditation timeline is aggressive. We looked at this long and hard when we put it together. And the way we pushed through hospice accreditation, we took the summer off, and that seemed to work really well for our team. And so we wanted to do that again. We feel that if we wait until fall, then all the staff are gone. It's hard to do the education that needs to be done and the kind of continuous reminders that take place as we're getting ready for the surveyors to come. So we did make the timeline aggressive. You can see that the policy review is July through December, and we just finished that. So the policies have all been reviewed once. We have created a substantial task list of items that need to be completed based off of the policy review. We had a kickoff here in the home health hospice office in September. We are in the throes of staff education now. We pulled our home health nurses out of the field on Monday so that we could give for half a day, not the whole day because we couldn't afford that, but for half a day to give them some OASIS education. With all of the turnover and the staffing challenges and not having a manager for a number of months, education got put on the back burner with our staff. And what we're seeing is that as we move forward with accreditation, we need to make sure that our staff have the tools that they need to really provide the care that we want to provide. So we're making that a priority. And so we had our first education. We have two more planned for December, and that will round out that piece for them. And there'll still be more to do, but that's a really big chunk. So policies to ACHC, who is our accrediting body, we send them to them, ask them to do a desk review. They send them back to us, say, hey, you need to fix this one. The others look good. And then so we're prepared when the surveyors come, and it's one less thing we need to worry about when they show up at our doorstep. We plan on calling for our survey April 1st, which means the surveyors could show up anytime between May 1st and June 30th, and then we will take the rest of the summer off. So that's the timeline. Next slide, please. So there are two primary policies that speak to the governing board, and we're just going to review those very quickly. This is the first one, and it speaks to the pieces that you are responsible for. When we did hospice and palliative care accreditation, they did not ask to speak to anyone from the governing body, but know that they certainly could, and if they were to, these would be the things that you would need to at least be aware that you are responsible for. So decision making, appointing a qualified administrator, adopting and periodically reviewing bylaws, establishing or approving written policies, human resource management, quality, QAPI, community needs, oversight of management, and annual review of the policies and procedures. Next slide, please. And then this slide speaks to the pieces that we specifically need to educate you on. And so that is where I'm going to spend the focus today. A lot of these are similar to hospice accreditation. So I'm going to specifically talk about organizational structure, overview of home health, QAPI, and complaints and grievances. And as we have developed our policies for home health, we have tried to keep them as consistent as hospice, just for ease of working through them and managing them. Next slide, please. Organizational structure is the same as it is for hospice, other than that we're focusing on the home health program rather than hospice. So we have a home health manager. Her name is Andrea Smith. She joined us in June. She is great, adds a very strong leadership skill set to our team, which has really been great. And then the nurses, CNA, therapy, and we don't have therapy assistant staff, but if we did, they would fall under her. We have an open MSW position, but once filled, that will fall under her too. It's important to note that while the accreditation is specifically geared to home health, as a leadership team, we work as a team. And so we are all involved in home health accreditation and all working together to see that this is accomplished. Next slide, please. So what is home health? There is a lot of confusion around home health, and justifiably so, because Medicare has made it extremely confusing. So we're doing our very best, and I'm going to speak to that in a little bit to provide some additional education. But home health is short-term intermittent care. It is directed by a medical provider. And it's provided by skilled clinicians in the home. And the home, again, can be, we do not go into skilled facilities, but it could be an adult foster home, it could be an assisted living home, or it could be an individual patient's home. Home health care is designed to help individuals prevent or recover from an illness, injury, or hospital stay. So our goal is to get patients back to baseline or to establish a new baseline. Home health is meant to be short term, and it does not provide activities of daily living. So if we're looking at the things that home health specifically doesn't do, we don't do medication management, we don't do lab draws, we don't do safety evals. Now, will we do a safety eval if we have the staff to do that? We would in certain situations, but we will not be reimbursed for that. So if we were to do a safety eval, it would be out of the goodness of our hearts and to be a really good team player with our hospital organization. Next slide, please. So these are the people that make up our team, the patient's attending provider. So as clinicians, we work under the orders of providers. And so we have to have an attending provider to seek those orders from. We have nurses, physical therapists, occupational therapists, speech therapists, social workers, and home health aides. We also have billers. I should have put them on here too. Billers, office staff, and then the administrative team. They all make up that home health team. Next slide, please. So what services are provided? I guess I jumped the gun and told you what wasn't included, so I'll go back to what is included here. Symptom monitoring for exacerbation of an acute or chronic condition. So oftentimes these patients are those that have been in the hospital for a short stay and are coming home, CHF, COPD, COVID. These are a lot of those types of patients. Education to patient and family caregivers following a new diagnosis, treatment, or medications. Also, oftentimes from a hospital, they go in with an illness, they have a new diagnosis, we pick them up. There may be medication changes, and so we are providing education on medication changes. As I said, medication management is not a skilled need, but medication education absolutely is. And so we'll go in and we'll help patients reconcile all of those medications and their new diagnoses and maybe changes in lifestyles that need to occur. wound care for pressure sores or surgical wounds. We have a lot of wound care that we manage. And so we are in the process of developing a wound care team that can better manage those patients because they really are just a lot of work, but it's really important care. So we're doing our best there. Assistance to patients in regaining strength, teaching balance techniques, and providing education on ongoing exercises. So this speaks directly to our physical therapy and occupational therapy team as well. And even speech will go in and help with swallowing exercises and such. Education assistance to patients in modifying their home environment and lifestyle to safely perform activities of daily living. So specifically, our occupational therapists will go in and if a patient has had, say, a stroke, and so now they are no longer able to get in and out of their tub. So how can we help them be successful? How can we help them become as independent as they possibly can? So transfer benches, putting up grab bars and poles and all of that, the occupational therapist specifically will help them manage that. Next slide, please. Who is eligible for home help? Medicare gives us very specific guidelines on who we can and who we cannot admit onto services. So to be eligible for home health, they must be under the care, and it says physician, but it is really a provider. So a nurse practitioner or PA just needs to be a provider who can give us orders. They need to have a skilled need. And a skilled need is interpreted as needing a professional. And it does not, just because a patient doesn't have someone to provide the service for them, does not make it a skilled need, right? So if they need someone to fill their medication box, but they don't have anyone to do that, it does not make it a skilled need. So we couldn't go in there for just medication management. So that's an important and a differentiator for us. They must be homebound. And this one is tricky because it's very gray. It requires assistance or a taxing effort to leave home. So can they go to church on Sundays? Can they go to the grocery store? Can they go get their hair done? They absolutely can. But what it means is that when they get home, they're exhausted and they have to rest for the rest of the day. Or they need assistance of someone to help get them in the car and drive them. So homebound status is tricky. But if they're able to go grocery shopping, go Christmas shopping, cut wood, they are not homebound. And regardless of whether they have a skilled need, we cannot keep them on services. Level of care needed for home health service is intermittent. So we do not provide everyday services. That is not anything that even if we were fully staffed, we could provide. It falls outside the scope of our practice. So if someone needs assistance even 4 days a week, that is, they require a higher level of care and really should be in a facility for that. And we have paid very close attention to specifically this piece as our staffing shortage has been challenging for us. But really, patients are better served if they're at the level of care that they need. And requires a face-to-face visit with a provider for that diagnosis for which the patient is being referred. That face-to-face visit can occur 90 days before we get the referral or 30 days after receipt. This was a rule that went into place when the Affordable Care Act was implemented. And if you think about it, at least in my mind, it doesn't make a lot of sense because we're saying this patient is homebound, but if they're referred to us and need a face-to-face, we're saying they have to get out in 30 days to see the provider. It's a silly rule, but it's one we have to follow. So we do require that we receive a face-to-face upon referral, because otherwise we won't receive payment for any of the care that's provided. Next slide, please. When we look at who pays for home health, we are very heavy in the Medicare side, which is nice. Medicaid is about 4.5%, and then we have a small contingency of commercial and other insurance companies. The benefit of having that high contingency of Medicare is we know exactly what the rules are, what we find, well, in Medicaid as well, but what we find with those other insurers is they vary by the insurance type, and so we're always having to make sure we're dotting our I's and crossing our T's, which we do, but it just is one more step for us to take. Next slide, please. So the payment model for home health is not nearly as simple as it is for hospice. So with hospice, for every day a patient is on services, you receive X number of money. So let's just say $200. And that is really easy. Medicare is not that simple. So here is the way they present it to us. And the model changed in January of 2020. So prior to that, well, I won't get into what they did prior to that, but since January 2020, we are now under what we call PDGM, and it's patient data grouping model. And in-home health, we have 60-day episodes. So when a patient is admitted onto home health, they're admitted for 60 days. And then if we still need to provide services, we admit them for another 60 days. What Medicare has said that within each of those 60-day episodes, we're going to pay you in 30-day benefit periods. So we have 32 30-day billing periods within each 60-day episode. They are using the patient dating grouping models. And so I'm just going to go through real quick. So if you look at the top in the blue, the admission source and timing, they consider five pieces to determine how much we're going to be paid. So we're never quite sure when we accept a patient what that payment model is going to be for us, what we're going to get reimbursed for. So they look at whether it's a community referral or an institutional referral. And so if it's a community referral, it's coming from a clinic or it's coming from a neighbor or a friend, and we get paid less money for those. If it's an institutional referral, it's coming from the hospital or a SNF, and we get paid more money for those patients. And it makes good sense. That is a piece that makes sense to me, because we're assuming if a patient was in a facility or in a hospital, then their acuity is greater, and so we're going to need to see them more. Love it. I can get on board with that. The other piece they have is an early referral or a late referral. So if we have a patient that's been on our services multiple benefit periods, then they would be a late referral and we get less money from those. If it's the first time the patient's been on our services or it's been a number of months since they have been on our services, then we would get an early referral, which means we get more money. So those are the first two pieces of the equation. We look at what the primary diagnosis is. Wounds, we get a little bit more money. Neuro, we get a little bit more money because those are two diagnoses for which we often have to provide more visits. Makes really good sense. Behavioral health, respiratory infection, we get less money for those. So that's the third piece. The fourth piece of the equation is what is their functionality? So we have documentation. It's called OASIS. It's this huge, long list of questions that Medicare requires that every home health admission they complete. For every agency, anyone that provides home health services, they have to complete an OASIS documentation upon admission and again at discharge. And what they ask us is, what is the functionality of this person? Can they dress themselves? Can they bathe themselves? Can they feed themselves? Can they transfer? Can they walk? And so then based on our questions, we get a certain number of points, and how those points add up depends on whether that individual is low, medium, or high, and that affects our reimbursement rate. So that's the fourth thing. And then the last thing they're looking at in this equation is our comorbidity adjustment. And we have a primary diagnosis, but what are the other things that are affecting this patient's health? And you can fall into no comorbidities, low or high, and again, that impacts how much you're going to be reimbursed. Very complicated, and we spend a lot of time looking at this every day and looking at every patient upon admission. So just two other pieces. We do have a very intense review of these patients at the time of admission to make sure that we are scoring them appropriately to get the highest possible reimbursement. But the other thing that I forgot to mention is that this information also plays into our patient satisfaction when they're looking at improvement levels. So when CMS looks at the OASIS information at the front end at the time of admission, and they look at the OASIS information at the time of discharge, and they compare those two. And if they see that the patient has gotten better, so if we scored them as a high functional impairment at the time of admission and a low functional impairment at the time of discharge, CMS says, woohoo, you did your job, you made the patient better, your scores go up. So it's really, and if it's the opposite, you know, we get a negative score. And so it's really important that we are scoring our patients appropriately so we can benefit from all of that information. And so we review that with our clinicians 4 days after they are admitted, every patient. And then the low utilization payment adjustment, it's a, what we call a LUPA. And so if Medicare says, based on all of this information that you've just given us, we expect you to see this patient at least 5 times. And if we see that patient less than 5 times in that 30-day billing cycle, then they will not pay us as much money. So we're very careful about the LUPAs too. There you go. Everything you might never want to know about home health billing. Next slide, please. So patient complaints and grievances, we do have policies in place. We utilize Quantros for all of our complaints and grievances, both those that come in from patients and as well as concerns that are raised by staff. They all go in. We have policies in PolicyStat, of course, and I just wanted to give you a brief overview of what that policy looks like. We ask that any grievances or complaints are reported to the supervisor within 5 days. So whether that is a clinician initiated or whether the clinician has received a complaint from the patient themselves and is entering it, we ask that it get put in within 5 days. The supervisor then has, we ask them to respond within 10 business days. And if not resolved, then the executive director would step in and also has 10 business days to resolve that. Patients are informed of their rights to file a complaint and grievance at the time of admission. That is a Medicare requirement, and we are also required to give them the number of the state that they can, and the KEPRO, who is our there's an official name for it. They're the people that you call to complain. That is not the official name, but that is who they are. So we provide that information as well. It is required. Once we are accredited, we will also provide the ACHC's phone number that they could call them as well. Next slide, please. So QAPI. We have a lot of QAPI. We have a lot of QAPI. It is home health is a highly regulated field. They have or industry. They have a lot of rules that they have placed on us. They have found that home health is also highly fraudulent industry, and so they have made the rules accordingly. So we have referral to admission. So Medicare requires that we are admitting our patients 48 hours after we receive the referral. I will tell you that sometimes we will go 7 days without even being able to reach the patient, which makes following that rule very difficult. But that is one of the rules, so we have a copy on that. Disciplines at start of care. Medicare requires that all disciplines that are ordered see the patient within 5 days, which is then followed by submitting that OASIS documentation that I spoke about within 5 days. So the only way you can have a complete OASIS documentation is to have all of the disciplines in within the 5 days. And so that is a challenge for us, particularly if you have a patient that has nursing, MSW, speech, PT, OT, like the neuros, our stroke patients, it's very difficult because we know that those visits are not short. There are a lot of questions for the patient, the family, and they're tiring, but that is a requirement that we are asked to meet by CMS. They require that we are having interdisciplinary meetings, right, that are all of our therapies and clinicians are working together to formulate a plan of care for that patient. Policies and procedures, we have policies and PolicyStat. We use a VNAA guidance for our procedures. And then notice of non-coverage, so our NOMNOC. Medicare requires that when we are planning on discharging a patient, we have to let the patient know within 48 hours prior to discharge, so that if they do not agree with the discharge, then they can call KEPRO and debate that. Next slide. Yes.
May I ask, I may have missed this, but what is the definition of QAPI?
I'm sorry. Oh, which
QAPI, the headline up there?
Oh, it's quality and performance improvement.
Okay.
Sorry, yes.
Sorry, yes. Thank you.
Yes. All right. Next slide. So that was the end of Home Health 101. Any questions? All right, moving on.
Yes, I do have a question, if you don't mind.
No, not at all.
But are you also going to be talking about hospice?
I'm coming into that right now.
Okay, well, I have a general organizational question, and I'll wait to the very end.
Okay, and so I have to 3:15, is that right? Is that right?
Yes,
that's correct.
All right, so I'm talking fast. Next slide, please. So 2021 accomplishments, hospice accreditation. We established a palliative care program. We hired that nurse practitioner in January. We ended the original pilot that we had been utilizing, and we became accredited in palliative care. So a lot of work done between January and July. We hired a home health manager. Yay! We hired a community liaison, which has been a great addition to our team. Patient-controlled analgesics. This is not quite in place yet, but I'm being really positive and thinking it's going to happen by the end of the year. So I put that in there. Core measures is something that we have implemented. Our leadership team reads a book, and then we put the information we have gained into action. And we read Dave Subs for our first book this year. And so our core measures are being included in our annual evaluations and will then be looked at for our 2022 evaluations. Core measures are related to those specific items that are necessary for the success of our business. So productivity, attendance, documentation. So we've implemented those. We've had a significant hospice donation, which I mentioned to you guys last time. And Light Up a Life is a hospice fundraiser that is taking place. You will see a tree going up in the lobby of the hospital December 1st. And that is also part of a community bereavement program. We have not been able to host that for 2 years due to COVID. And so this is also going to be representative of a community bereavement program as well. Next slide, please. 2021 challenges. Team morale has been hard due to COVID, due to staffing. We tried to take the summer off to give them a break. And then we also participated in some healing circles. Mary Fortman and Jackie Levin were kind enough to offer those to our staff as well. Communication is always a challenge. In fact, I just told my manager today, you can never over-communicate. So we have had consistent monthly newsletters. We revamped our Education Wednesdays and our morning huddles. I implemented a TAMI time, so an opportunity for me to meet directly with staff and provide them information on a different lens. So when I'm looking at the budget, when I'm looking at 2022 goals, what am I specifically looking at? And hopefully we had our first one in November, to open lines of communication. And so that was a really great experience. And then we revamped our Tiger Text forum groups. Community education is a challenge for us. People don't understand what we do. And it's not easy to understand, right? It's complicated. So Crystal, our community liaison, has been a great help. And I think we're going to make strides in that. Next slide, please. Next slide, please. So staffing has been a challenge. We are working hard to get through it. This is our productivity. You can just see that for most of the year, we have been running at capacity or above. Next slide, please. So current staffing, open positions, you can see we have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 open positions. We have 3 individuals on leave, and then we have 3 individuals in transition. Some of those were internal hires that we cannot move until we get the replacement hired, and then one of those is also in orientation. So it has made I am complaining a little bit, I guess, but I'm not different than any other department. I know that everyone is struggling with staffing, and I also know the organization is working really hard at recruiting, but it just continues to be the song we sing. Next slide, please. So if you looked, I just thought this was interesting. I'm not going to spend much time on it, but if you look at where our staffing has been, you can see the unpaid leave of absence is the light pink. Admin on leave is orange. Employee paid leave is the dark red at the top of some of those bars. So a considerable amount of people who have been out. And then you can see the PTO requests tick up in the summer and the fall, in the summer months, June and July. And as short as we were on staff and as hard as it was to let those people go, I also knew that if we didn't do that, we would have the potential of having even more staff gone because they needed that break. So next slide, please. And next. So I spoke to this a little bit in home health, but this is departmentally, including hospice, home health, and palliative care, where our breakdown comes from. And so if you combine all those programs, you'll see that 91% of our funding comes through Medicare. Next slide. Brief overview of revenue by month. The gray is 2020, the blue is 21. And again, this is for both programs, home health and hospice. Palliative care is not included in this. They have a separate, their revenue it's not formatted in the same method. Next slide, please. So hospice financial review, you can see the top line at in the graph below is for 2020. And you can see that the admissions and discharges are a little bit higher. It's important to note that this information for 2021 only goes through November 8th. So those numbers are going to go up. The one thing I want to point out is that in 2020, 20% of our admissions in home health were admitted for 5 days or less. So not only does that increase the churn and burn on the staff, but when you look at the amount of care that's needed and the way we're paid, there's no way to recoup the costs when patients are admitted for 5 days or less. So it's really important to have those longer lengths of stay in hospice because again, that is where our reimbursement comes from. And so that's on the financial side. And if you just look at providing the level of care to patients and families, 5 days is just too short. You cannot give them the full benefit of the hospice benefit because all you're trying to do is manage the crisis of the patient dying, right? Oftentimes these patients are in pain and it's a mess. So those are the things that we're working on in hospice. Next slide, please. So if you look at home health, so now you know what each of these things are because we just talked about it. You can see that the episode timing, the early and late referral were pretty even. The functional impairment levels, we are working really high to make sure we're scoring those patients appropriately so we get the highest reimbursement. A lot of our referrals are from the community, which means we don't get paid as much. And the comorbidity adjustments. This is an area we need to work on, and it's all about the specificity of the diagnosis. And so we know that that's an area that is weak in our reimbursement, and so we're actively working on that. And then the LUPA percentage is 11.7%, so almost 12% of our patients, we get a lower amount reimbursement because we don't get enough visits in. LUPA threshold on average is 4, and then billable visits is 6. Next slide, please. This is a chart on where our highest primary diagnoses land. You can see that neuro and rehab are the highest, which is good. Those are the highest reimbursements. And then our average expected reimbursement is $1,900. It's important to note that all supplies come out of that as well. So it's all visits and all supplies. So when you have a wound care patient, we currently have a patient who has pleurics drains and they use 8 a week. And they're $60 a piece. And so when you look at how that adds up, and they live on the south side of Brennan. So when you look at all of those things, we know that there are patients that we're going to lose money on. So it's really important to be careful with the resources on those patients that we can be. Next slide, please. Again, highest expenditures across the board are staffing, supplies, and recruiting. Next slide.
And actually, can I have you just go to the very last slide for me, please? Thank you. So those were QAPI pieces, quality improvement, and you can read through those at your leisure, but I just wanted to touch base on our 2022 goals. We reviewed these in TAMI time with staff last week, and so we have good input on them, and we're ready to go. But we tried as much as possible to integrate our goals into the hospital's goals so that they are consistent and in alignment. There are some, obviously, the initiatives are our department specific, but as much as possible, we tried to be consistent with the hospital. Okay, 1 minute over. Questions?
Yes, I had an organizational question, if I might.
Yeah.
If somebody could take us back to that organizational slide. It's way in the beginning.
Yeah, it is.
And my question is, first of all, Tammy, I want to say that I unfortunately have way too many friends who are in hospice and home health.
Yeah.
But fortunately, I have heard nothing but good reports about the service they get. So I just really want to thank you and your team. So where are you in this organizational chart? It just sort of went by me a bit.
Yeah, sorry, I was pointing. So I'm the executive director. So I report up to Tina.
You report to Tina.
I do. I'm a lucky girl.
Okay. And all right. And then, okay, so great. So that explains my question. I just wanted to make sure I understood where you fit into the overall umbrella.
Yes.
Excellent.
Are there any other questions from the board for Tammy?
Yes, I just wonder if any providers do home visits to either home health or hospice patients.
Yes, so Dr. Mattern, of course, does some home visits for us. Renee, who is our palliative care nurse practitioner, all of the visits that she provides are in patients' homes. And so she provides those visits for our palliative care patients, but also for some of our hospice patients. And then we do on occasion have Dr. Carlson has been out to do a home visit. And we recently had another provider go out, and I can't remember which one it was, but they do on occasion go out. It is not consistent practice, but yes, they do.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Any other questions?
I was going to say, is Dr. Bowman still the medical director?
Dr. Mattern is our medical director. Dr. Bowman is what we call a hospice physician, and so we have a hospice medical group that consists of Dr. Mattern as the medical provider, Dr. Bowman as a hospice physician, and then Renee as our nurse practitioner.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Any other questions? All right, well, Tammy, thank you for a very thorough, detailed report. It could have been a little bit longer time frame. Next time we'll give you more time.
Yeah, and if anyone has any questions afterward, please feel free to reach out to me. I'm happy to answer them.
Great. Thank you so much. Mm-hmm. All right. At this time, we will recess and we will be back at 3:30 with our business meeting. All right. Thank you. Welcome back to the business portion of the November 17th, 2021 Jefferson County Public Hospital District Number 2 Board of Commissioners special meeting. It's our pleasure now to begin with our favorite board action, and that of commending our employee, provider, leader, and team of the quarter. So Mike and Caitlin, will you please make the introductions?
Yeah, I think I will. My part is to introduce Caitlin. So Caitlin, you are on.
Great. So why don't we go ahead and begin? And I know this is always tricky on Teams because I'd love to be able to see the folks' faces, but we luckily have the photos. So Shanda Johnson is from our dietary team. She is a true leader that holds the respect of everyone in the kitchen through her dedication and camaraderie. Over the past year plus as lead cook, she's taken on a challenge to ensure the success of the JH dietary department. Shanda is always approachable and always willing to give advice and encouragement, as well as customer service with a smile. She has a positive attitude, sense of urgency to make things happen. She represents professionalism and passion in everything she does in the kitchen. And specifically, they called out the phone calls to the kitchen floor, or the kitchen from the floor staff, can sometimes be stressful, and she has a way of elevating the situation and getting problems resolved. So we're very excited for our employee of the quarter. And I'm hoping she's on, but again, it's always a little tricky on here, but let's give her a round of applause, please. So our provider of the quarter is actually doing patient care. So what I'd like to do is, he's going to try to sneak on. So if you don't mind, Brittany, can we jump? And we're hoping, I'm going to keep checking to see if he jumps on, because we'd love to be able to honor him between patient care today. So our rehab team, and we've got a couple different members on because I can see some faces. So this team is truly overdue for a nomination. Some of the therapists have often covered shifts in the inpatient part of the hospital on top of their full outpatient caseload. I personally can speak to the fact that one of the therapists on Friday came and helped me out in the emergency room after finishing his full day of clinic. It was just another example of exemplary customer service. The front desk has taken it upon themselves to cover the breaks of the COVID screeners, so they may have their breaks and lunches on top of their already busy days. The OT team has been amazing at working with ortho upstairs for last minute needs and splinting. With over 20 plus providers, rehab has shown that a mixture of teaching, education styles can truly work harmoniously together. It's reassuring knowing your colleagues support you. During the most stressful times of COVID, they stayed open and maintained caring hands and positive attitudes. I would also say that many times they ended up being a different kind of therapist as patients were processing all that was happening with COVID for that hour-long visit. As a team, they have become more like family during those times than I think actually during all times. So congratulations to our amazing rehab team. And then why don't we jump to our leader of the quarter, Corey Quigley. And I know Corey's on. So Corey, any chance you turn your camera? Oh, there she is, masked up. So Corey's our leader out of oncology and infusion. She's our manager of oncology and infusion. Her approach to leadership combines both empathy and advocacy in a way that fosters a supportive and caring team environment. She's an incredible listener who creates space for our feelings to be heard. Literally, she has feelings jar in her office. Corey really understands that true leadership comes in the form of action. In the past 9 months, she's been met with challenges, but has always risen to the occasion by advocating for the needs of her team, and I would add, and patients. We're able to do our best because Corey matches our enthusiasm, dedication, and passion for excellent patient care. The exceptional patient care we're able to deliver in our clinic is a direct result of her fantastic leadership skills. It is truly an honor and privilege to have Corey as the leader for the oncology and infusion clinic, and we cannot wait to see where she will take us next. So congratulations, Corey. So I'm going to do one quick look. I do not see Dr. Harris on, so I'm going to do it anyway. And as always with providers, patient care comes first. So Dr. David Harris actually had numerous nominations for a couple of different reasons, but I will jump into this one. We are thrilled to nominate primary care physician Dr. David Harris for the provider of the quarter. Dr. Harris shows kindness and compassion for his patients, colleagues, staff, and community daily. In the height of the COVID-19 pandemic, he was quick to help and ready to volunteer no matter the task. As the vaccine team operationalized the vaccine clinic, the team created education materials and consent forms in Spanish. The team soon realized that getting the message out to our Spanish-speaking communities in Jefferson County was still a challenge. Knowing that Dr. Harris is fluent in Spanish, he was approached to help with the marketing our vaccine clinic. He jumped at the opportunity to help all members of our community by recording messages and getting those out. Also COVID-related, Dr. Harris volunteered to provide pediatric vaccines to our pediatric patients, highlighting his willingness, kindness, and compassion for others. Words used to describe Dr. Harris include kind, approachable, patient, relatable, team player, steady, and methodical. We're lucky to work with him and thankful we can count on his kindness and willingness every day. So another great provider. And congratulations and thank you to all of our quarterly winners.
Yes. Hey, Caitlin, I concur. It's an incredible group and certainly extraordinarily well qualified. I will say about add on to Dr. Harris's. In addition to him being fluent in Spanish and helping produce that tape, he also has a large cohort of Spanish speaking patients. And what we learned in reaching out to the Latinx portion of our population is that it's a relationship built on trust, and that trust is gained sort of one interaction after a time, one after another. And Dr. Harris, we kept triangulating off of him and used the goodwill that he had generated by taking care of so many Hispanic-speaking patients to sort of build to a better place than we are today. So I greatly appreciated that.
Well, thank you all. And on behalf of the people of Jefferson County, the entire board gives our heartfelt thank you to all of you, Chanda, Johnson, Dr. David Harris, Corey Quigley, and the rehab team. Your inspiring leadership and the sacrifices you make to provide the highest possible of quality of care to our community makes us profoundly grateful you are members of our team. So, thank you all. All right, comments from other board members? Okay, then we will go on to the more mundane business, and we'll address the minutes of October 18th special session and October 27th regular session. Is there a motion to approve?
So moved.
Okay, did Matt say so moved?
It was Bruce.
No, I did.
Okay, Bruce, and then Mari seconded.
Yep.
So all in favor of approving the minutes, raise your hand. I don't see Matt or Bruce.
Aye.
Okay. Aye.
All right, those not in favor, same sign. I think it was unanimous, so those are approved. So we'll now go on to required approvals. Anything anybody wants to take out of there to discuss? If not, then could we have a motion, please?
So move.
Is there a second?
Second.
Is there discussion?
Nope.
All in favor say aye.
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 Aye. Okay. Those opposed? Right. Hearing none, it's approved unanimously. Now we can go on to our quality report from our Chief Patient Safety and Quality Officer, Brandy Manuel. Brandy?
Good afternoon. Thanks for having me. And it's always a hard act to follow, following our providers, leaders, and teams of the quarter. And I think Dunia said it best when she did the board education, but you know, as I think about their role and I think about what I get to talk with you about each month, it really is those faces and those individuals who make it such a joy to present this work. They do a great job. So just echo the kind words you just said. So we'll take a quick look at our quality and safety snapshot, and then we're going to talk a little bit about one of our core measures, our emergency department throughput. We've kind of talked a little bit about that over the last couple months, but I thought we might just spend a minute and pause and take a look at the data on a deeper level. And then, as always, we'll hear from our patients, and we'll wrap up by taking a look at current projects. So just really quickly, things were generally okay through the third quarter. You see, we have a couple of things, though, that are highlighted here in a color that I don't love. The first one being zero avoidable healthcare acquired harm events. We did have two patients who fell with either a temporary injury or additional testing required. Now, injury is categorized as pain. So even if there is not a broken bone or a laceration or a cut or a bruise, even pain following a fall meets sort of the criteria for injury. And that was the case in this particular one. We had a patient who went to sit down, was standing next to the bed, went to sit and kind of missed the edge of the bed. There was an employee right there and no serious harm. There was some temporary sort of post-fall ice pack required, but patient did well afterwards. And another patient who fell, unfortunately, again, this was no harm, but because the patient had a baseline status of dementia and was a little bit confused, we wanted to make extra sure that there was no harm. So an x-ray was done on this particular patient. So because extra testing was required, it falls into this category as well. Fortunately, both of those patients ended up doing okay. And then the other one, workplace violence. So, you know, there is a lot going on. It does feel that generally, you know, we're seeing volumes tick up. We're seeing tensions in some areas tick up. And we had three reported instances in the month of October. One was from a vendor to an employee. One was from a patient to an employee. And one, unfortunately, was employee to employee. So a couple of areas to follow up on. Caitlin and Chris lead our workplace violence prevention task force and work. And I know they're doing a deep dive into that. But it's definitely, as we're going to take a look at here, we're seeing just increased stress, and I think that sort of bubbles over into the way that interactions are occurring in some cases. So actually, if we go back just one second, you'll notice our core measures continue to be yellow. So we continue to perform fairly well with our reported core measures. The one that we continue to miss the mark on is our ED throughput. So I wanted to take just a minute to kind of share with you what is underneath that metric. And there are several different elements, but I wanted to point out some things that are going fairly well. We are exceeding our targets for getting patients from arrival to their room and then provider within a very short period of time. So last month, it was about 7 minutes to the room from the time that they walked in the door and 9 minutes to get to see their first sort of interaction with the provider, which is within our goal. So that's great. The areas where we start to see the numbers sort of tick up a little bit is in that full workup. And so the initial contact from the provider to patient disposition, and then the decision to admit. So from the time we make the decision to admit the patient to the time the patient actually makes it up on the floor, there can be a little bit of a delay. And a lot of that is dependent on sort of all of the activity going on in the house, what's happening up on the floor, whether the staff is tied up with another situation. And so those are just a little bit longer. And then specifically, an area that we do see much longer throughput times is in our transfers. And over the last several months, we keep talking about how finding placement and finding beds has been more and more challenging. And that's very true for our behavioral health patients. So you'll see this graph on the bottom, and the N is fairly small, but the axis over to the left is time in minutes, because as we measure throughput time in the emergency department, it's always measured by minutes. And you can see this pretty significant uptick over the sort of end of the second quarter and beginning of the third quarter. And we're continuing to see patients have a hard time finding placement. At the time that I put this together, we had a patient in the emergency department for, I believe it was nearly 2,000 minutes who was being held as we tried to find placement or find beds. So it continues to be an area that's challenging, not just in our region, but across the entire state. And if we take another look at just behavioral health and kind of the impact of the state of the state, here are a couple of data points that we look at fairly closely through our incident command team. On the top, you've got primary care, and on the bottom, you've got the emergency department. And what you're looking at is the number of behavioral health encounters per 1,000. And the dark blue line represents the previous four-year average, and the lighter blue is the rolling 12 months. And so you can see that in primary care, at least, we've been pretty consistently seeing more than we had seen in years past. And then down on the bottom, it's about where it's been, not a significant difference in the numbers. But what is significant, I think, is the kinds of things and the acuity of the patients that are coming into the ER. So what you see over on the left-hand side, the top conditions that we're seeing that fall into this category are suicidal patients, disorders related to alcohol, anxiety, fear, depressive disorders, and then schizophrenia or other disorders. And the two in the red have seen a pretty significant uptick over the last year or two. So the acuity, the overall need of this patient population is significant. And then I wanted to call out just a quick note of appreciation for the work that our primary care group has done. As we know, it's not really all about just that crisis intervention piece, though that's certainly a critical component to responding to patients in need. But it's also, what do we do once that crisis is over? And how are we making sure that those patients are receiving the care that they need in the way that they need it? And how do we know that it's making a difference? So what you're looking at here are a couple of the behavioral health quality indicators for primary care. And the top one is the percent of patients that were not improved without a psychiatric consultation, which is a weird way of saying how many of our patients were referred into psychiatry who needed to be. And the goal is 14%. And you can see here that right now we're right around 5%. So lower is better. And so they are exceeding their target. You'll notice the little bit of an uptick over the summer. There were some staffing issues and some transitions in the team that were correlated to that. And so really what we're focused on is kind of where we had been normally and where we are now and the good work that's being done currently. And then the bottom is the percentage of patients whose PHQ-9 improved. And that's a depression screening tool that's used by our providers. So the goal here is to see higher numbers. So this is the number of patients whose score actually improved, meaning their depression screening score was better. And you can see that nice improvement continuing. And then I just, since we were talking about the emergency department, thought it would be a good time to take a look and see how things are going in terms of our service excellence and our patient satisfaction. You can see here our graph represents the overall rating of the facility according to our patient. Last month we talked about, of course, that score being focused on a loyalty score. So this is sort of the 9 or 10 only that gets counted in this number. And the yellow line represents the top quartile, which is our goal. So we are at or above, in most cases, sort of the average amongst all hospitals reporting into this tool. And we are just short of that top quartile goal. And you'll notice the N here, I don't know if you can see it, but the N is really small. So these are quarter. Each dot represents a quarter, and you're looking at anywhere from 88 to 100 responses. So only about 30 plus responses a month. And again, last month we talked about the transition to our real-time surveys. That work is continuing, and we have a team that's working hard on making that change. So we're really hoping to see much bigger N sizes here. And also we'll have more timely access to the feedback, so we'll know earlier what opportunities we had for our patients. And I'm going to pause because I just noticed Dr. Smith is on the line and he's got his hand up. Dr. Smith, did you have anything you wanted to add?
Well, I figured instead of creeping on you in silence, I would jump in here.
Well, thank you and welcome. And since I am talking about your team, Dr. Smith, please do feel free.
I am acutely aware of that. Thank you. You know, I just thought it's worth having the board know that, you know, all of these things that Brandy's pointing out with the difficulty of moving patients to an appropriate destination has had a profound impact on the flow. Over the past several days, both because of behavioral health patients we have nowhere to send and nursing home patients that are not being accepted back to Life Care Center, you know, we have 10 functioning beds in our emergency department, and we have had as many as 7 boarding patients. And for most of the last 3 days, it's been 5. So that means we're not only are we functioning as a 5-bed emergency department where we're supposed to have 10 beds, nurses that are supposed to be managing acute problems are forced to do, you know, longitudinal care tasks on patients who, you know, need a glass of water, need to go to the bathroom, you know, but definitely don't need emergency room stays. So it has been quite interesting and chaotic. I mean, everybody's been handling it well, but it's quite a strain on the system, and hopefully it's not a long strain. But anyway, just that.
Thank you, Kent, for that input. That's above and beyond. Thank you.
Appreciate so can I ask Dr. Smith, what are the issues with patients not being accepted back into the nursing homes?
So there was a COVID outbreak at the Life Care Center, and so, you know, we sort of have this twin engine from them. They're sending COVID patients to us, but they won't accept any admits there, nor will they take a lot of their COVID patients back, or at least some of them. And so, you know, they're throwing patients into our mix, but not relieving any of the patient pressure once they get here. So I know the social worker's been working very hard to try to get people to alternate destinations. But, you know, again, we've had 2 and 3 and perhaps more people sitting in the emergency department that are simply waiting for a nursing home bed, some of them for days at a time. So
is this a statewide issue, do you know, Kent, or just a regional, or just us?
Well, as far as I know, our immediate crisis is Life Care Center's crisis.
It is a statewide crisis that when at the height of the pandemic, when hospitals were full of patients and were treating 15, 16, 1700 COVID patients, I think 1850 was the peak. That the challenge was staffing and available beds. However, what was aggravating that more than the uptick of COVID patients is all of the patients that didn't require acute care, but there was just no place to send them. SNFs and assisted living centers, they have more discretion in receiving and sending patients to other care zones, where when the patient comes to the hospital, we have to accept, and we cannot discharge until there's a safe place for that patient to go. And all across the state, those safe places, for good reasons, that if a staff member had symptoms and was tested, many of them would err on the side of caution and not go on lockdown. But it's just catastrophic to a community where there's only one skilled nursing facility, because what we have learned is that this is the healthcare system is a very fragile ecosystem, and and if one component of it underperforms for whatever reason, it really impacts all of the others. So, yeah, that I appreciate Kent bringing this up. This has been kind of this on and off challenge, and the social workers and the hospitalists and the ED department and the house supervisors have done an incredible job reaching out. Port Townsend, Squim, Port Angeles, really anywhere where there was an available bed, and we just really got hit hard by it end of last week and the beginning of this week. But it's a big stress on the entire hospital. It's a huge stress on Kent and his team. And thanks for stepping in and taking care of patients for multiple days, Kent.
But then my question is also, how does that affect our rest of the community when they come and seek emergency care?
Do they exactly like you would think, Mark. Suboptimal and frustrating because we are so dependent on these other other components of the community healthcare delivery system, every positive COVID test has this exploding effect in healthcare, where you've heard Caitlin talk about all of the contact tracing that goes on, and then if a fellow employee comes up in that contact tracing, well, that employee is pulled out of the workplace and is tested and then is off for 3 to 5 days, which is the responsible thing. That's what you do. But when you're already tightly staffed, in our case, it creates, it aggravates that. And in the nursing home cases where I think they've got, higher risk with severe illness with their patient population, that they're very conservative and they will just shut down admissions. So it backs up other parts of the system and impacts our ability to take care of patients in the emergency department, impacts our ability to do elective surgery cases, and just prolongs this state of barely hanging on, which I think Kent and all of his colleagues and everybody upstairs are feeling.
So is the state doing anything to try and mitigate this situation?
Yeah, they really are. But Mari, they're trying to make COVID go away. I mean, the issue is that there are all sorts of things you can do. The state's thrown money at it. They have incentivized their and deputized DSHS workers to make those admissions decisions go faster, but something they won't do is if an organization has COVID outbreak, they will not force them to accept patients. And there's not EMTALA when it comes to nursing homes. Nursing homes, many of them are private. And they can ultimately control the patients that they choose to accept or don't accept. The Dr. Barry has stepped in and engaged with Life Care Center and talked with them about their corporate policies of how long they are on lockdown after a positive. But it is a monkey wrench that is real, because you don't want to start admitting patients before you fully understand the outbreak and know that it is tapped down. It's just one of the insidious complications of managing this that just lies directly below the surface. I'll reference Caitlin. Any given day we have dozens of employees impacted by this. And that's the same in assisted living centers and nursing homes. So I guess the short answer is I do believe that the state is doing everything, is managing every manageable component of this. It's really been amazing over a weekend they were trading emails with us, trying to expedite the eligibility of a patient for funding to go to a nursing home. I've never seen anything like it. Good. But it's just issues of these COVID outbreaks or when one staff tests positive or when a patient tests positive. We've all seen those things spread like wildfire, mm-hmm. and the state is appropriately cautious to step into that. And also they don't have the authority.
Well, it is as it is, I suppose.
All right. Any other questions about the ER situation?
I just want to commend Kent and his staff for doing what they can do. And it must be a really challenging situation. And certainly from my point of view, I can just only imagine how things are there.
I noticed in the dialogue of the box there, the people who were affected, some of them were very complimentary on how they were treated, which is the best scenario I think you could hope for.
Yeah, I did want to point that out.
The wait times have been long because, you know, we just don't have rooms to put people. Most people have been very gracious about that. You know, some less so, but no, I, Mari, this is, the nurses, the techs down there, they're just great. You know, it's a great team. I'm really proud of them and happy to be a part of them.
Yeah, I think we're fortunate in that Kent and his team and Dr. Harris and her team, because it's, yeah, Kent and Tracy, you know, they are on point with making the decisions to border and then the decisions when the patient can come upstairs because we have safe staffing up there. And it's very fluid and frequently a hospitalist will bounce down and see a patient while bordering, and Kent and his team will do the same upstairs when necessary. I mean, it's been remarkable, not only the how hard everybody in the emergency department and upstairs are working, but just the fluidity and the teamwork approach, all, you know, to make this challenging situation manageable and provide the best care possible for these patients. Because, you know, certainly a patient bordering in the emergency department is not good for anybody. Mm-hmm. And I think our staff is doing an amazing job.
Yeah, and this is a handful of comments, but most of the comments mirrored these, despite being very busy, just an acknowledgement of the care that was given and an appreciation for the team in the ER. So thank you to Dr. Smith and the team for continuing to care for our patients, even in the setting of pretty significant challenges. So here are some current projects and focus areas that we are looking at right now, a couple of new ones on here. The NRC transition to real time, our go live target date is January 1st. So that sounds like a really long ways away, but it actually feels like tomorrow in terms of just how quickly time goes by. We are wrapping up this year's quality data to be ready to submit our MIPS data in the first quarter with Dunia and her team. And then our data and analytics and reporting team are engaged in a really comprehensive kind of analysis and overview of the structure, the processes and the governance all around data and analytics to help continue to build what they have done such an incredible job building already. And then just a couple of other follow-up items. Emergency management had a handful of things to follow up on after the shakeout drill that we did. So working hard and spending most of December closing those action items out. And then we also activated incident command on Monday during a power outage. And Jake did a great job of leading the teams. Our leaders, our staff jumped in and sort of stepped in all kinds of ways that they don't normally have to do, just to make sure that things worked smoothly. And we had a couple of follow-up items there as well. And finally, I just wanted to call out, tomorrow is National Rural Health Day. And so these are just pictures of cards that came in from our community in the last couple of months to thank our healthcare teams. They truly are incredible. And the last few months have brought with them a lot of challenges and a lot of hardship and, you know, a lot of things that we wish we could change, kind of like the emergency department discussion we just had. But they've also brought together just some real examples of teamwork and compassion and care. And so I wanted to just thank our team, our leaders, our providers, our volunteers, everybody who makes this such a special place to work. And I'm not allowed to go into too much detail, but keep an eye out. Usually this time of year, there is an announcement of a performance award in the area of patient outcomes. And Jefferson Healthcare is often on that list, is all that I can say about that. So with that, any other questions or discussion?
That's artful dodging of an embargo of a press release. So.
Just saying, keep an eye out.
any questions from the board? Okay, well, thank you, Brandy. We appreciate it, and great report as usual.
I guess I have a quick question.
Okay.
About the slide with the workplace violence, does that mean physical violence, or could it just be verbal violence?
Great question. Verbal, and actually all three of those were verbal in nature.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. All right. Then if there's no further questions, we will go on to our financial report by Tyler Freeman, our Chief Financial Officer. Tyler?
Hey, good afternoon. So this report will look a little bit different than it usually does. Since we're a week in advance, we have not closed the books quite yet. So we've got a few slides just to show what things look like in Epic, and then I also have some education. So next slide. So we went back and looked how October finalized in the Epic system. So as of 10/31/21, it looked like total charges were going to run at 105% of budget, and our cash collections were pretty close to goal. Days in AR were at 38.7. So all of that bodes well for ending October in a pretty decent spot, and we'll see how that finalizes when all the adjustments are booked and when we close out the month of October. And then on the next slide, so far how we're looking in November. So November, it's pretty early on, and we also have probably some vacations and other time off coming up, but at least to start out the month, we're in a really good spot, 109% of budget, and cash collections are also quite a bit higher than our goal of 338,000, and days in AR, a little bit of a drop from where we're at in October. So all good indicators for the month of October and November, but like I said, November, May, hopefully the starting strong will mean that we'll finish where we want it to be, because I'm assuming things will wind down a little bit with the holidays. So, and then next slide. So for the education piece, I wanted to go over the rural health clinics reimbursement methodology and some changes that were made this year. And go to the next slide, please. So, and this is just in regards to Medicare, but just kind of some basics on rural health clinics. So a lot of the time when we reference rural health clinics, we talk about them being completely cost-based when it comes to Medicare. And that's not quite correct, just because the way that Medicare pays us is they pay us 80% of cost. And so that is what our all-inclusive rate is. It's based on our cost, and they only pay for 80% of that. They expect the rest of that to come from patients. And so patients are responsible for 20% of charges. And so what that means is that we could potentially be reimbursed 100% of costs, but if we're charging less than our costs and we're only getting 20% of that, then we're going to be less. So there's kind of this dance between our charges and our costs to make sure that we are actually covering our costs when it comes to Medicare. And then one of the additional nuances to those costs is now they are capped. So There was a Consolidated Appropriations Act signed at the end of December of 2020, and it had some reimbursement changes that, started April 1st, 2021. And so for a hospital our size, what happened was they established a base rate. They established that using 2020, and that will be our grandfathered rate going forward. So since we had a rural health clinic already in operation by then, it's a good thing that they allowed us the grandfathered rate. The new rates are quite a bit lower than where we're sitting at right now. But effectively, our costs are now going to be capped at those 2020 values, adjusted for inflation. So they will be adjusted each year by the Medicare Economic Index. So for us, that means we have 6 rural health clinics that are now subject to caps. That means if we want to open up a new rural health clinic, it will also be subject to a cap that is not based on any of its previous costs. It will be based on the capped rate that Medicare comes up with. There's also 26 other critical access hospitals that have 63 rural health clinics in the state of Washington that are also going to be subject to these new capped rates. So the good news, 2020 obviously was a very, very high cost year. And in addition to those high costs, we had less than optimal productivity, and they allowed us some exemptions for productivity standards. Rural health clinics have to, providers need to see, have 4,200 visits per year, and advanced practice professionals need to have 2,100. And those were definitely hard to hit in 2020, and they did allow us some grace. So our rates would be better than if they used any other year to cap us, basically.
Question, Tyler?
Yes.
Does telemedicine play a role in this at all?
It would be included in the visits.
Okay.
And what about vaccination clinics where we saw providers?
Vaccinations, I believe, are included in the visits as well. I would need to confirm if that's if you get a full credit for a visit for a vaccination or not.
But my real question is, with inflation running at close to 6%, are we going to do quite well then? Out of the, if it's going to be.
Yeah, I will. I actually have how we're doing on the next slide. So on the next one, I've got where we landed so far. It's sorry, I can get you too, Bruce, if you want. I see your hands up.
Yeah, I was just wondering that the Medicare Economic Index, how does that compare with like the regular? I mean, is it because medical costs tend to run higher than the average economy? So as far as the increase.
That I haven't actually ever looked to see how that runs compared to general inflation. So I'm not sure. I'm assuming that it's pretty close on pace, but I can look that up and provide that during our November Finance Committee meeting. I'll have that number for you.
Okay, thanks.
This is how things are looking currently, and this is based on our August 31st interim cost report. We are required to do an interim cost report midway through the year. We worked on that with DZA, and it was used. It was created using data through August 31st, and through that time frame, we did have 3 rural health clinics that were their costs were exceeding their caps. So South County, Townsend, and Port Ludlow all exceeded their caps. And then I have the math to kind of show what that means in terms of a total dollar impact. So the all-inclusive rate, if you look at South County and we are over our cap by over $40, you just multiply that out by the Medicare visits, because basically they're not paying you that $40 even though you have that cost. And so through August, the impact of this is likely to be 28,000. This is just an interim cost report. So there will be a final. We still have the rest of the year to increase productivity and manage costs. But it is important to remind everybody that these caps are now in effect. So we do need to be cost conscious. We need to be productivity conscious because we will be paid less than what our actual costs are if they are exceeding our caps. And so this does have some future risks for us. We'll need to analyze any changes that we make to the clinic just to know what that's going to do for our volumes, what's that going to do for our costs. A lot more effort will be required in analyzing any changes that could potentially be made to our rural health clinics. So,
quick question, Tyler, on the MC, I'm assuming that those are Medicare visits, the MCI.
Yeah.
And do you know what percent of the visits in South County are Medicare versus self-pay and or insurance? And is that different from our other clinics further north?
So I believe... I looked at this when I pulled it. I can't remember the total number for South County for total visits, and I don't know if anyone else on the line would have that data handy, so I don't have to fumble around for it. But, there are visits or there are clinics that obviously see more Medicare than others, and the caps only affect our Medicare rates. So any commercial contracts that we have, the Medicaid rates are not impacted by this change, anything like that.
Yeah, I was just curious as to whether or not that impact is a greater percentage of the overall operating expenses of the clinic than it would be for the other clinics, depending upon the mix of patient reimbursement.
Yeah, I believe South County has one of the lower Medicare visit amounts. For some reason, I think that they have a higher Medicaid percentage is what I'm remembering, but I don't have that number off the top of my head.
Okay, thanks.
I should have called it, but I didn't. All right. So any other questions on this? As I said, I just wanted to, the change went into effect. I didn't see that it was something that was discussed before. So I wanted to bring this to your attention and also kind of have that be a focus for when we do make any changes to our rural health clinics going forward, just to know that we've got to do a little bit more math than we may have had to do it in the past.
I think another thing to point out, because it just adds another layer of complexity in how we manage all of the factors of related to healthcare financing, is that, as Tyler points out, our cost-based reimbursement includes the to get to cost includes the patient contribution. So if for one reason or another that patient contribution is not collected, then our reimbursement for that visit is south of cost. So I think it just adds complexity to this ongoing discussion about a responsible collections policy that not only meets the needs of our community, but I think everybody on this line would agree that a financial plan that relies on sub-cost reimbursement is probably a plan that at some point is going to get you in trouble. So it just adds a layer of complexity to some of these really difficult policy decisions that we have to address.
And just to add in, Medicare is 43.85% of the case mix there, and Medicare and Medicaid is 25.13. So let me say that again. Medicare 43.8, Medicaid 25.1.
Thanks, Jen.
I hopefully can see this part of the WISHA advocacy in DC in the future for rural hospitals.
Yes, this will impact every rural health clinic, and yep. It also impacts starting new ones. Cost of a new building or anything like that included in the overall cost-based reimbursement that you would typically get is probably not going to be there under these new caps. We've got to figure out a new way to make the math work.
Yeah, I think this is all, we a couple of years ago, we followed Olympic Medical Center's lawsuit against CMS over declaring SQIM no longer, declaring the SQIM clinics no longer provider-based and subject to site-neutral reimbursement. And the definition of site-neutral is CMS thinks that all clinics, regardless of where they're located, regardless of how they're licensed, should be paid the same if they're offering the same services. ultimately, Olympic lost that litigation. So the SQIM campus now is not treated as part of the hospital, and in their case, provider-based clinics versus rural health clinics. My thinking is that is a policy initiative that our public payers are going to continue to advance. And rather than sort of one fell swoop, or I think with respect to rural health clinics, they are in effect grandfathering the existing rural health clinics with that more favorable baseline. But I think the likelihood of our costs growing at a higher rate than the additional, our increases in reimbursement are probably pretty great. So I think over the long run, this will be harmful to us.
Yeah.
And secondly, I think that the whole issue of starting another one is pretty much off the table, because I dare to think what the baseline for a new rural health clinic would be. Probably, would you say 60%, Tyler, of what we are seeing now?
I think the new baselines, if you were not grandfathered in, were around $100 per visit. And that will be adjusted each year, but I think that's, if I'm remembering right, it's pretty close to 100 per visit.
Well, it's good to know that we have smart people that are knowledgeable about this and are working on it ahead of time. Thank you for bringing this to our attention, sad as it is.
It seems to me it might be just a method of stopping any more rural health clinics being started in rural communities, which is detrimental to rural communities.
Absolutely.
And it's not just in Washington, just nationwide.
So are these rules state-specific, nationwide? What are the leverage points?
These are nationwide, and a part of this is it's kind of as a lot of nationwide programs, it's take from one side and give to another. So if you have less than 50 beds, you have been able to get reimbursed for your actual costs, which ours has been 200 to 300 per visits. And if you've had more than 50 beds, you've been paid at the less than $100 per visit rate, and they're starting to even those out. And so they're increasing the caps for those with more than 50, and they're capping the ones that are less than. So. starting to cap.
Yeah, I wish I could say, but you're exactly right, Mari. That I don't think there was anything unintentional about
exactly
about the consequence of no longer rural communities no longer sprouting up rural health clinics. But I truly, I mean, I think that this whole philosophy of cost-based reimbursement, whether it be provider-based clinics located outside of hospitals, I mean, that was where they got to last go around. I think they're probably, but I think that public payers will continue to advance this site-neutral philosophy. So I expect to stay very active and very engaged, or Jefferson Healthcare expects to stay very active and very engaged advocacy at the federal level for any more adjustments to provider-based clinics, because we have a bunch. They're just on our campus that require and receive significantly higher reimbursement than non-provider-based clinics would get. And I do think probably by virtue of paper cuts that the rural health clinics will continue to be more and more challenged. And there will be a greater emphasis on, you know, on managing costs when that gap grows too high. And it's a different situation in a rural community. And I do think that access to care for the poorest and the most vulnerable will be adversely impacted. Not this year or next year, and not in this community, but 5-10 years down the road, when organizations say we just can't do this any longer.
Okay, Tyler.
All right. Thank you all. And then we will, at the November Finance Committee, we'll go over the typical close income statement, and then I will send that out to the rest of the commissioners afterwards. And then I believe we had on the agenda to approve that in the December board. So that's the timing that we'll have for all of those, but thanks.
Don't have a question. I'd just like to compliment to Tyler on this very interesting picture that he has up right now.
You can thank Brittany. She helps me with creating these.
Fabulous view.
I didn't take this. I can't take credit for it.
Mm. Right. Anything else then? Any other questions?
I thought that was a rendition of what our new remodel and expansion would look like, Mike.
I'm not volunteering to wind the clock.
It could.
All right, then. If that's the end of your talk, Tyler. Okay, thank you very much. And then we will go on to our administrative report. Mike Glenn, our Chief Executive Officer. Mike.
Thanks. I have to tell you I absolutely didn't enjoy, but it was interesting to talk about something other than COVID that makes my head hurt, you know, in trying to manage Jefferson Healthcare. Prior to this worldwide pandemic, we would talk about those things all the time, about adjustments to reimbursement and you know, where we thought policy was going and how to position for that. And it's almost just been an afterthought the last 18 months. And I think appropriately so, because of the emphasis on getting through this very difficult time. But also, I do think that there has been
a slowing in policy changes in D.C. and Olympia, too, that I think that sort of just been, we'll leave them alone for a couple of years before we start challenging, you know, the hospitals and clinics to provide more services for less reimbursement. But it, I guess it was, I will say that it was kind of nice to talk about something other than COVID. Okay, next slide, please. So I'm going to just kind of go through our volumes again. You're used to seeing these, the volume or the slide on the graph on the left or chart on the left is phone calls that continue to come in, and on the right are testing volumes, drive through or the like, and you, normally the testing kind of mirrors community prevalence as well as busyness of our procedure activity, because we still are requiring a test before we will do a procedure. Next slide, please. The primary care clinics and the specialty clinics have continued to be really busy. I think this is probably less a function of COVID community prevalence and more a function of people just needing to see care. That I think a year ago when anybody got the sniffles, we just were certain it was, you know, it was COVID. Today there are so many cold and flu bugs going around that now it's the default is, oh, you just probably have that flu bug. But that's generating a lot of visits to the primary care clinics, and they're doing a great job with strained resources to meet that need. And the specialty clinics is the same, urology and women's clinic and wound and cardiology, derm and orthopedics continue to see patients that, you know, that have struggled with their specialty issues and now are looking forward to getting them addressed. Next slide. Oncology infusion, a slight downtick last week of October, and surgery kind of continues to climb. And what we are seeing, we are still tightly managing elective cases. I still think that the ceiling is scheduling one elective surgery case a day. And that's if we've got line of sight on reasonable staffing. But what we are seeing is far more add-on cases, and these are emergent cases that need to be done. So when the schedule was already really tight, that add-on cases were really straining our OR crew. Because it would require that the on-call crew, either one crew stay late or the on-call crew come in and do that case. And Tina and Donica and their teams have came to this conclusion that the add-on cases are now so predictable that we should just try to come up with elongated hours and to plan for them, which I think will be a great relief to staff that there's a plan for that add-on case that, for reasons I'm not sure we completely understand, is routinely showing up. So that's good work, and it will without a whole lot of additional resources, I think it will add a significant amount of benefit to staff that are pretty taxed by what we've expected from them. Next slide.
And these are the emergency and express clinic visits. They continue to bounce around. On the way, on the drive home yesterday, I was listening to actually she's a professor of logistics at Ohio State, and she was talking about queuing theory, basically managing lines, right, and how organizations attempt to manage lines or queues, whether it's in grocery stores or primary care clinics. And the most challenging element of that work is variability. And, you know, there's almost predictable variability in a grocery store, right? The morning before Thanksgiving, you can probably count on it being pretty busy, or the day before Thanksgiving. We have unpredictable variability for the most part in our emergency departments and as well as in our clinics. So you look at these numbers and you think, well, it appears that things are probably softening a little bit, and that's good. But at any, the distribution, the unpredictable distribution of these patients could just be boom, 90% in a 4-hour period. And it just runs over staff and really challenges our ability to pace that care and meet all the needs of our patients in a timely basis. But it's just part of the life of the emergency room provider, and Kent does a great job of reaching out when he needs additional resources and doing with what he has when he doesn't, or dealing with what he has when he doesn't. Next slide. I wanted to go over a handful of sort of issues that we are working on that I think are important I just wanted to update you on. First, I think our biggest challenge and our highest priority right now is filling unfilled positions. And while every community realizes that this challenge is nationwide, and it certainly transcends Jefferson healthcare. And what we're learning is that it might even be more difficult in rural communities like ours. But we've sort of reached this point of all of that doesn't matter. We have to figure it out. So our approach is this is the most important thing, filling these unfilled positions. We will continue this work until we are done. We've added recruiters and human resources and continue to blitz different media outlets to try to get the attention of folks who are either dissatisfied in their current employment or looking for a place to move to. We've also stood up a multidisciplinary hiring task force that is consulting with HR, but also looking at workflows, looking at FTE allocations, and also really looking at virtual positions to see if there is work that can be tasked outside of the clinic. I talked earlier, Mari, about the multiple challenges of staffing, and one being the exploding implications of a potential positive test within employee. But another challenging implication is just what's going on in the nationwide workforce beyond healthcare. I'm not aware of any hospital that isn't working on this, and it's the worst possible environment to try to make huge gains in hiring. Mm-hmm. But
We've identified it as our highest priority. We are tracking it on a weekly basis, throwing all kinds of resources at it. And for reasons that were not entirely clear to us, it appears things are starting to loosen up. For a while, there would be some key positions where we wouldn't have one person submit a resume for weeks in some particular areas. But now there's starting to be a little bit more activity on the front end, which we know will lead to more hires on the tail end. So we will keep you posted on that, and we'll continue to make it a priority. Second, the wind blew a little bit on Monday, and as we have learned to count on, when the wind blows in Jefferson County, it's not a matter of if, but when and how long power will go out at Jefferson Healthcare, and it did. So what our response to that is, we stand up another incident command committee to manage the power outage, and I think we managed it well. We have lots of experience at that, and it's like all these people show up with their tool belts and their flashlights and know what their task is, and we also have good relationships with PUD and some of the other players, so we usually have an understanding where the event occurred and some ETA on when we think power will be restored, which is important because it is our practice to not start another elective surgery case while the power is out. So if it's a long-term power outage, we likely would cancel those cases, but if we were being told it should be back up in an hour or two, we'll likely just delay them. Secondly, we always learn from these that if you walk around the hospital, you'll see red plugs, particularly upstairs in the clinic areas, and those are electrical outlets that are connected to our emergency generator that have full power when the generator switches on. And every time we do these, we become aware of areas that probably need to be added to the emergency generator, and that's far more challenging than you might expect. But so we take them in clumps, but necessary. Up in dermatology, the Mohs lab, I think we learned wasn't connected to the emergency generator. So that is put on a list. And we just also learn of that the operating room's humidity got out of whack, which delays putting that room back into operation, even when power comes back on. So managed it well, learned from it, and I think it was another example of management and directors and Jefferson Healthcare employees responding to a circumstance beyond their control. More important, maybe not as acute, but more important than today's workforce challenge is finding workforce for tomorrow and 5 years from now and 10 years from now. So the Washington State Legislature is Representative Eileen Cody pulled together a task force of hospital administrators, directors of college nursing programs, and all sorts of folks to try to talk about how we can expand the capability of colleges to accept nursing students, and then ultimately expand the graduated nurse pipeline. And a key component of that is the clinical nurse experience that a nurse requires after they've completed didactic and before they complete their program. And the first meeting indicated that there was wide variability with that.
And also, as you might expect, during times of staffing crisis, hospitals weren't able to participate as robustly in providing those opportunities for nursing students as they once had, which makes perfect sense when you are scrambling to provide safe care to your patients upstairs, but what makes no sense at all in helping to expand the nurse pipeline going forward. So we had a great discussion with the first task force meeting. There's another task force meeting. Representative Cody is very engaged in this and recognizes that part of the solution might be resources, because frequently the expectation from the colleges is that a couple of nurses come, at our case, four or five nursing students come through Jefferson Healthcare, and there's very limited, if any, reimbursement for that proctoring. And if you think about the bigger organizations where they're dealing with, 25, 50, 75 nurses, that there's some reimbursement, but not enough. So the answer to the question, how can you take more of these of nursing students on, in many cases was, don't require us to subsidize it. And I think there was also some discussion about innovative ideas on moving that forward. So I will keep you updated on the results of that task force. And lastly, I wanted to give you an update on the progressive design build planning process. The first step for the 65 building replacement project. The first step was to make application to the PRC for authorization to proceed with the design, progressive design build approach. And as I think I may have mentioned to some of you, we're the first public hospital district to be granted eligible for this approach, and only the second hospital in the state, second to Harborview, which I think is a feather in our cap. I think it speaks highly of Aaron Vallett and Jake and our team in demonstrating an ability to maybe go this different route and yet still be good stewards of the community's resources. So the first step was to get authorization to utilize this progressive design build planning process. The next step is to put together a request for qualifications, an RFQ document that you send out to all interested contractors and design teams. And what happens is that contractors and design teams come together and they jointly respond to this RFQ. So we received, five applications or responses to the RFQ, and they are the contractors and the design teams that you see doing the big projects in Seattle, and pretty much within that five, every hospital construction project that I can think of over the last decade, one of these outfits have done. So it really I think it opened up a higher caliber, I think, of contractors and possibly design teams by working in this methodology. So that's step one. The next step is we will whittle that down to three and then ask them for an RFP. And then they will respond to and submit a proposal on how they will help us with this process. We speak of the broad outline will be the needs that we've identified in our master site plan. But the purpose of the process is to design, scale, and scope 65 building replacement project, which we are on the hook to do.
And then any other expansion projects that we think make sense and that we think we can afford. We are getting closer to this work beginning. And I think that's when we will be seeking your input. We'll be likely seeking the community input. Because the way we define it, there's really three phases of this. The first phase is the replacement project that the city of Port Townsend conditioned our building permit for the ESSB that we accomplished, within a decade or so. When we built the ESSB, so that's very real. Secondly, we sort of identify the opportunities where we believe we can provide new and improved space. Some of our primary care space was designed when primary care was practiced significantly different than it is today. And we think that a primary care design that mirrored what actually goes on in a contemporary primary care environment would make that patient flow far better and make the provider experience far more enjoyable. So the second phase is really of the space services that we think we can do a better job of. The third phase is expansion that I think I've mentioned to some of you, that every nook and cranny in the ESSB is full right now. And we have identified through our demographic study and projected healthcare utilization for our demographics, additional services to be brought to our community. And ultimately it will be this board deciding if those are community needs that we should attempt to respond to, because they're that would require more space and more resources to do. So it will be an important decision. I think we are all motivated to try to meet every community need that is out there. However, we may have to determine that for whatever reason, this is as far as we can go. But I want that to be an active decision and not a passive non-decision. That work is still kind of plodding along. Probably in like February, end of January, 1st of February is when we will make the decision on the design and contractor team. So probably shortly after that, this design work will begin. Next slide, please. Just a reminder of the governance retreat for us, January 12th, via consulting, and Carmen Bass and her team will be out and will continue the work that we have done over the years. And I think some of you might be engaging in surveys and maybe even talking with Carmen and her team. But I view that as a good exercise for us. The third week of the third or fourth week of January, WISH's Virtual State Advocacy Week. I think the year before the pandemic, we sort of started the state advocacy day, where we would all go down to Olympia and darken the doorsteps of our legislators and share with them our interest in advocacy and lobbying. COVID has shut that down last year. They believe that it would not be safe to do that again this year. The virtual advocacy is a little more challenging, but necessary with everything in play. And then lastly, I just wanted to add one more thing, and that is the state auditor is virtually on site. That every other year we have our state auditor's office compliance audit
And that began technically yesterday. And so some components of that, years, there used to be, there's a voluntary entry conference that we have skipped the last couple of years. They just sort of go over the different pieces that the audit will encompass. We're recommending that we skip that this year. There's the very important exit conference where they go over any findings, and that will be a board meeting, and we can expect that to occur sometimes in January. I think what we've done before is actually included it as part of our board meeting, so we don't have to set up another board meeting just for that exit conference. And there's also risk assessments where the auditors meet with the chairman of the board and the hospital CEO and ask them about any risks that we may be aware of with respect to financial impropriety. So I think that Alyssa and Brittany will soon be in the process of scheduling that for Jill and for me. We've done well over the last several audits, and I expect us to do well with this one as in addition. That concludes my administrative report. Unfortunately, Joe had to scramble over to the clinic, so you won't get your CMO report, which I enjoy the heck out of, and I trust that you do as well. A CEO CMO update is the hospital continues to be really busy. We have 15 patients, and I think up to about an hour ago or so, one incredibly sweet baby in our family birth unit. Of those 15 patients, at least to this morning, I think there were two COVID positives. I was going to tell you about the skilled nursing facility transfers and how they continue to challenge us due to admission limitations, but we talked about that. By the way, every morning at 8:15, there's a staffing conference, and Tracy Harris and the House Soup and Tina and several members, the AOC and Donica from Surgery and Environmental Services and Jake from Ancillary Services get on the line for a 15-minute call where we just run through patient activity upstairs, admissions, predicted admissions and discharges, patient activity in the emergency department, how many are boarders, transfers, what the rate limiting factor with transfers are, whether it's no place to send a patient, waiting for clearance, or just arranging transportation. But by the end of that 15-minute call, we have an assessment of how the day will look with respect to staffing. It's an incredibly helpful call. But to throw another complication that today we had 5 callouts, which for us is an extraordinary number, and it's this 11th hour variable that house supervisors and the scheduling coordinator have to manage, and we marvel at their ability to contact folks and to switch folks around. And in one area we were overstaffed, and we basically got to the end of that with the unit being fully staffed. One of our managers agreed to be a charge nurse, but it's one of those obstacles that you don't know you're going to have until 6 o'clock in the morning. But staffing continues to be tight, but we're hanging in there, and With respect to vaccinations, DEM continues to provide shots for 5-year-olds and 11-year-old, 5 to 11 cohort. They provided a bunch of shots last weekend. They're providing a bunch more this weekend. We're also engaging with them about what we anticipate to be a higher demand for booster shots in the not too distant future. And we are hoping that they can continue to take the lion's share of that. But continues to be a great collaboration between the Hospital of Public Health and DEM in addition, the clinics mostly during well child visits are providing COVID vaccinations for the 5 to 11 cohort too. So we're cobbling it together, and I think we are staying keeping up with demand. Doesn't feel as overwhelming as it did when we were getting very little vaccination and we had, you know, 1/3 of the population demanding a COVID shot tomorrow. I hope not to relive that frenzy again. But overall, I think we're staying out in front of vaccinations and trying to meet community need. So my apologies for Joe not being here, he'll catch up with you next week, next month.
Thank you, Mike. You did double duty this time.
Yep. Any questions for me?
Yes. Any questions for Mike?
Thank you. Very comprehensive.
Well, if I might, I want to thank Mike for his willingness to present to Rotary. He's going to talk about the plans for our hospital expansion. Everyone is welcome. It's on Tuesday, the 30th of this month at 12 noon. So hopefully Mike will be able to clarify correct some of the misperceptions that people might have had from what they have heard so far or read in the leader.
Is this virtual, Case?
Yes, it is virtual, and I'll send out a link to the commissioners.
Thank you.
And to the staff, for that matter, maybe because I think it should be a very interesting presentation. Not to put you on the spot, Mike, but.
No, I can't imagine staff clamoring to get another 20 minutes of me that they aren't required to attend. But I might be surprised.
Yes. Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Mike, again for doing everything for my you and for Dr. Mattern, and sure look forward to seeing him next month.
Yep.
Okay, so then we will go on to board business. Case, our representative at the Board of Health, do you have something you'd like to say about that?
Yes, just very, very briefly, though. Usually this meeting is the week after the Board of Health meeting. And this month, in fact, it's the day before. So the Board of Health is meeting tomorrow. So I cannot tell you what happened, but I could tell you that it should be a very interesting meeting, and that Dr. Berry has provided a very interesting and disturbing report for the Centers for Disease Control, which is all about COVID-19 hospitalization rates among children and adolescents and the severity of COVID-19 in children. So that's going to be a big topic tomorrow. And just to say that I actually did a courageous thing and offered to meet over coffee with somebody who I knew who was very disturbed about the decisions being made by our public health officer and by public health. And I was able to avoid talking about the data because he had a stack of data that was that he wanted me to review, and I politely told him that the evidence was quite clear that discussing the data really did not make any difference in changing minds. And at the same time, we agreed that we both were terribly concerned about children and adolescents. He is the father of an adolescent boy whom I met a few years ago. It was a very interesting conversation, but I'm not convinced that I made any inroads in changing his point of view about vaccinations. And then just finally, there will be an interesting presentation tomorrow by Laura Tucker, who works for Public Health. And this is going to be a presentation on global climate crisis. She does a lot of education around that issue. So the presentation that she will be doing is Climate Change and Public Health, the Health Effects of Climate Change. And she's going to be doing that along with Mike Dawson, who also works for Public Health. So I'll report on that at the next meeting and keep you posted.
Okay, great. Thank you, Case. And it'd be interesting. At least you'll have some things maybe to report to the Board of Health from here tomorrow.
I've been taking notes very carefully.
Okay, thank you. Here's a reminder, on December 1st, we have our special meeting to discuss generative governance and conduct our annual agenda evaluation, along with the other meetings that Mike mentioned. Is there any other board business? Mari?
I was just thinking, Tammy Tarsa talking about home health and hospice and our responsibility as the overseeing governing board, whether it would be something that we should bring up in our future meetings, our board meeting, maybe the governance one. Should we have a two-person board committee from this board to be the, if you like, the go-to people for our responsibilities?
I think that might be something we could discuss on December 1st briefly.
That was just a thought that came to me during the meeting here today. I think
that's a great idea. We can add that. It's not too late.
That's it.
All right. Anything else from any of the board? Okay, then we will go into the meeting evaluation, and then we will go into executive session. And I think between the meeting evaluation and executive session, we will take a 10-minute break. Does that sound good to you, or do you want to go straight through? Hands up for those who want to go straight through. Okay, up one. Okay, it looks like it. And those that want to take a 10-minute break in between, hands up. Okay.
How about 5 minutes?
Oh, 5 minutes? 5 minutes? Okay, 5 minutes then. All right, so let's go ahead with our meeting evaluation. Matt, you're again on the top upper left of my screen, so you start.
Good, great meeting. Lots of great information. I appreciate all the presenters for their time. Yeah.
Okay. Case?
Yeah, truly remarkable amount of information. Truly remarkable staff working under challenging situations. I will not make my usual pitch, but I would like to have more opportunity for the board to really discuss some of what we've heard.
You just made your usual pitch, Case.
Yes, I changed my mind, Marty. I changed my mind.
It wasn't as long as usual. Okay. Thank you, Case. Bruce?
Yeah, I mean, even though this is a shorter meeting than, you know, what we normally would have. It's still jam-packed full of good information, and I continue to be surprised and proud of how everybody at the hospital, I mean, these reports could be really bad during these times, but everything is really.
Yeah.
I mean, it's really good, and it's enlightening, and it's uplifting, and it's just an amazing job that everybody's doing.
Maury?
Well, I agree with everything that's been said, although, of course, I don't disagree with Case saying he wasn't going to do something and did do something. But I must say, for all the people who have been acknowledged today, whether it's provider, the team, the individual person, I've had over my years here either taken care of somebody, worked with them, and experienced their services. And whether it's rehab or Chanda in dietary, Dr. Harris, who I worked with when he was just here as a temporary years and years ago, a very thorough and thoughtful provider, and Corey up in infusion, where I am a patient from time to time. I cannot thank them all enough, and the rest of the staff, for the work they've done, not only on a day-to-day basis, but through this challenging and really quite awful last 20 months. So kudos to all of them. I just think they are all absolutely spectacular.
Okay. And the good news of the bad news of being chair is I have to be last. And
that's a privilege.
Everybody says all the things that I would say ordinarily, so I don't have to say it. So I echo everybody, and especially being honored to be part of this organization. So thank you, everybody.
Yeah.
All right. So now we will, we are concluding our business meeting, and we will take a 5-minute break and return at 5:19. And then please reconvene on the link provided by Brittany. But we will come back here before we go into executive session. So
okay.
See you here at 5:19. And we are going into executive session to discuss possible purchase or lease of real estate and performance of a public employee. Our attorney, John French, is present. It is no action will be taken. We will return to regular session in 30 minutes at 5:50. And we will now, board members, please reconvene on the link provided by Brittany.
Oh, Jill?
Yes.
I'm sorry that I was distracted. Did you indicate how long executive session was going to be?
Yes, I said 30 minutes.
Okay, I'm sorry.
Got it. Yes. Thanks. Okay. Okay, it is now 5:47, and we're back in. We have concluded executive session, and we're back in our special session. But we won't leave until 5:49 because that's what we promised our public. And no action will be taken. So, want to sing us a little song?
Peace. On top of spaghetti, covered in cheese.
Hey, you're good.
Hold on to your meatball in case someone sneezes.
I lost my poor meatball. No. On top of spaghetti, all covered in cheese. I lost my poor meatball when somebody sneeze.
It rolled off the table
and onto the floor, and then my poor meatball rolled out of the door. It rolled down the garden and under a bush. It's 5:49.
And then my poor meatball was nothing but mush.
On that note, I think we can entertain a motion to conclude the meeting, and none too soon.
No move.
All right.
Second.
Okay, discussion. All right, everybody have a happy Thanksgiving. Great
Thanksgiving. Yes. Easter.
Likewise. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Thank you for a great meeting.
Well, thanks, everyone.
Okay. Stay safe.
Yes.
Don't lose your meatballs.